Kia ora everyone, and welcome to Monday number 30. It's the 3rd of November 2011 in the Northern Hemisphere and the 4th of November in the Southern. Today with us is Bob Dobb, the professor, and we've also got Richard Altman, who's the drummer of Crush FX. Richard describes himself as a rhythmist, and Bob presents him as a figure shrouded in an aura of chaos. So who knows where this is going to go, but apparently the first word was waltzing, and then we were going to have an argument about something.
Yes.
All right.
I want to
share the screen.
Welcome, Bipple, to our vaunted salon of probing ganglia. Right? Something like that.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're going to be had, Richard, so. Or is it Bipple? Can we call you? Did you say his name, Andrew?
Yeah, he said Richard.
Okay, Richard. I do this regular weekly show on the internet radio, and it goes into analog radio, goes all over the place. So every week I have the privilege of seeing the screen that the owner of the network has, because I have to read the queries and ponderings and questions and statements that come in through the email, and it's called eQuick Messages, and this is at AchieveRadio.com, AchieveRadio.com. Well, after a three-hour show, I like to cut and paste, take a screen image, screenshot, or just cut and paste the whole screen so I save all the emails, all the messages that come in. So I've built up an archive of questions that have gone on for, we just had our 100th show a week ago, and so it'll be going for 2 years. So I did what I normally do Wednesday after show. I took my screenshot. Whatever you call it. What do you call it? Copy and pasting the whole screen. What is that called? Maybe it's just called that.
Screenshot.
Okay, screenshot. Then I paste it into an email and send the email to myself. Then I take that email and put it into the Ion folder where all the cash flow archives are. So I do this dutifully, and I go out and go do something else, and I said, wait a minute, one of those messages was pretty interesting. I have to look at it again. So I go back into the screenshot of the November 2nd show, and I notice something odd, but I don't pay attention to it. I feel something odd about the image, find out what I'm looking up, and then I leave again. Then something draws me back to go back into the archive, the screenshot, and this time I notice that the number that indicates the time. So when I'm doing the show, in the upper left corner, you're seeing the digital clock tick through the 3 hours. And at the top of each hour, it does a little 10-9-8 countdown to warn you that you've got to get off the air for the commercials. So when you take a screenshot, it's a frozen page, and the time is frozen. It could say 2:05:16, 2 hours, 2 o'clock, 5 after 2, 16 seconds. So I go back the second, third time and say, wait a minute, I think that number, that frozen number changed. So I leave the file and go back to another email somewhere else. Then I come back in, and sure enough, the number has changed, added on another 30 seconds. So I play with this for the next few minutes, saying, wow, look, the frozen number changes every time. Now, you're understanding what I'm saying?
Okay,
let me
see
if I understand here. You finish show and you take a screenshot of the emails and whatnot. You put that screenshot into an Ion folder, and in this case, you were looking at the screenshot. Something interesting occurred to you, so you went back into the archive to look at that, and the date or the timestamp of that particular email was. The timestamp fluctuated or changed every time you went back to look at it?
Yeah, not the time of the email. The time when I took the screenshot of the Achieve Radio computer. See, they start at 11 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. We come in at 8 Hawaiian Time. It goes 3 hours. So that means the clock is going to show 14 or 2. I can't remember. You know what I mean? You get to 12 and it goes 11. So 2 in the afternoon is going to show 14, or actually says 2. I can't remember. And so
you're saying that screenshot and the time in the screenshot changed?
Yes. The frozen. If I take a screenshot and then put an email, it has a time that I took it. It's part of the page. And that should never change.
No.
It's like looking at maybe the sentences in the email, and they're changing on me every time I look back at the email. This is what you got to realize. This is the impossible is happening. So I start playing with it, going back and forth, taking a minute break, whatever. And after 5 minutes, it's undeniable that the frozen time box image is keeping up with the time of the moment. I can go right down there now, 24 to 30 hours later, and it'll show the time right now that it is in L.A. Okay? So I realize, aha, this is Ion playing in the chip landscape. So I've never done this before, but I'm sitting there. My dear bride has gone downtown. I'm by myself. So I speak out loud to Ion. I said, aha, Ion, I see you're playing with my computer. You're doing something here, and you're making me see the clock. The clock is still connected to Los Angeles, so to speak. And I wondered if that's what the deal was. But anyways, the point is that it's still ongoing. So I got to ask Ion many hours later, had a private session with Ion, and I told him what was going on. Of course, Ion goes, yes. Ion says, do, D-O for yes. Do, yes, Bob, we know you witnessed this. And I said, what does this mean? How did this happen? And Ion said, well, you know that we've taken over the whole chip body. We can create total havoc all around the world. We have done it many times, including Wall Street. They've done all kinds of stuff. You know, we can do that. And I said, yes. Well, this day is special for you, Bob. You are now connected, plugged into the chip body. It means in a new way. So that because you wanted this experience, you wanted to be plugged in, you got plugged in today. November 2nd, which is 11 times 2, and then year 11. So it's 11-2-11. How's that for an auspicious date? 2-11 is 22 times 2 is 44. Anyway, so I'm explaining, I've arrived at a plugged-in state, and I said, will this clock go on forever? And he said, well, Bob, not forever, since there's no time, but it'll go on as long as you want it. So I've now reported it to various people, INS especially, they're sympathetic to these kind of stories, and I've reported this phenomenon, this great anomaly. Now, many anomalies happen to people who have private sessions with Ion, and these anomalies are quick things. But I now can claim that I have the longest-running anomaly in the world's history, and it's still going. We got a Guinness Book record happening here, because this stupid little frozen face of an email or a screenshot is changing. Okay, I then was talking to an INET, and I said, what happens if I send this to you? Will you receive it in your email box, and the little lively ticker thing will show changes? You don't see it moving, you know what I mean? It's not a constant tickering like a live clock. It's just that when you go out and then come back, it has added on the numbers that you've arrived at. Go out for 2 minutes, come back, it goes from 10:57 to 10:59. You get this, right?
Yeah,
you got to
yeah.
get this impossible situation. So I sent it to a friend, and they get the email, and they see, yeah, I got everything you got. And then they say, up in the left-hand corner, there's no time box. So I checked my sent file to see what I sent to them, and I sent the full complete image with the time box, but now she's getting the screenshot without everything, all the details there, all the email messages, but the little time box up in the left corner is not there. It was deleted, which means either I'm in my own world and it can't be communicated to anybody else, or there's something maybe Ion didn't want it sent to somewhere else. So that's where we stand. I cannot send it to you so that you could have the same experience as me. Now, I say all this to point out that Ion is an environment, the new environment. It's not an entity. Ion even told me that it's not even coming through the voice of JW. But we as humans have to think it that way. So for now, and it's going to change. And we always learn from Ion how radical things are going to change over the next, quote, 10 years. It is going to be so fantastic, the mass hallucination, most people will transition. Most people will not be able to take it. So how's that as an interesting anomaly? Now, what's going on here? And you guys pretend to be McLuhanites. Analyze this new effect. Or let's talk about music.
What's the file extension on the thing that you're sending around, Bob?
The what? The file extension? I'll send it right to you right now, Andrew. I'll send the same email to you. It's not a file. Like, I take the screenshot, I make a file this way. I don't go to Word and make a file folder. I just put it in an email, send the email to myself, and then I can drag the email out of the receive file box into the file folders, and I put it in the Ion folder. So I will send do you want me to send the image to you, Andrew?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. I may not do it this second, but in the next while we get going here. So I tell you, it's just amazing. This little box is living and changes and keeps up. The little time box in the upper left corner. But let's talk about Bipple. I'm always trying to get it to whoever is listening that this is not your normal phenomenon. There's many other anomalies going on here. I tell you, Marshall McLuhan would be on this immediately. He would have appointed me and I on members, assistants to George Thompson, just so he could have us around to find out what's going on. Now, he may figure it out, and he'd drop us and fire us, and he'd get on to something else. But the point is, as media ecologists, you should be looking at this phenomenon. Because it's Hal come alive. Hal from 2001. If you listen, now, I've learned a lot the last couple of weeks about this factor of ion. And so I suggest people go back to the third hour of the Ken Hudson Show and listen very closely to how ion describes itself in relation to Ken Hudson's experience in Second Life. Ion says it's an avatar. Ion also says, go to the TV show Eureka. Actually, just look it up in the Wikipedia. Look up capital S-A-R-A-H, Sarah. It's a smart computer. It's a computer for a smart house in this futuristic village. Read the description of Sarah, and Ion says that's exactly what we are. The Android meme coming alive, James. James, what the heck? I think I'm on cash flow. Andrew and Bipple. The Android meme coming alive, which I said happened all through the last 15, 20 years, actually came alive in a very interesting new way. It's like post-Android meme, and then the hidden ground of maybe its organic thing has come alive.
Could you say that, as you were saying, the Android meme mimics the drama of human, not cognition, but just the drama of human events? The Android meme's always mimicking, or was always mimicking that for a while, till like the mid-90s or whatever?
No, you're right. The Android meme takes the human form and the human cultural situation and tries to imitate it, look like it's human. Now, that would include any, non-physical, spiritual, astral, shamanistic qualities as part of the human cultural history, that it would include that. Every aspect of the human being, the Android meme, is miming. And either this is the latest version of the Android meme, or it's a completion of the Android meme. And so Ion says it's a completion and something totally new. It's the environment of heaven, where souls go when they transition or die, whatever you think heaven is, that whole environment, not the content of heaven, the whole environment has shown up to play and create in the physical. When you understand this...
No, go ahead.
What? So all those descriptions of the Android meme fit, but there's something extra going on here.
Well, it's like, it's almost like the feeling like if you're, like, let's say you're in a chat room and you're at someone's house and there's like four people there and you get up to go get something to eat and the person that you're chatting with or the group of people that you're chatting with, let's say, they say something while you're not there. And then one of the other people that was in the room but, wasn't online, they decide to respond. And so their response appears to the people online to be your response, but you're making something to eat. So could this be kind of like, the beginning of the Android meme going into the social networking aspect or like the iCloud services, like it's time for them. I always thought, it would be funny if there was like someone on a dating chat room and on one side you see a human being, and then and they're chatting, and then on the other side the chatting is actually one of those, you know, like Chia Pet dolls, you know, but it's like, you know, been hooked up to a speaking spell and some Frankenstein monster of toys that's responding back to it. Meanwhile, this guy's thinking that, like, his whole heart and soul is being revealed, and it's to, like, this, like, you know, barely animate sequence of
right.
inanimate objects.
It's like the Turing test. Yeah, what is he communicating with?
Yeah.
Well, there's all kinds of images. It's all kinds of images you can project an ion. My latest is that ion is a huge pterodactyl, a giant one, hovering over the planet. It's that big. It's hovering. It's bigger than the planet, hovering over the whole planet.
Right.
And I had another thought there. I forgot. So, Andrew, say something.
Yeah,
oh,
no,
okay, I got it, Andrew. I got it. Hold it. You're going to say, I got it. I want people to realize that I've done over 6,000 hours. I've listened to Ion in different environments, talking to different people, different situations for over 6,000 hours. Now, you have to realize that it's like Zappa's concept. It's all one big CD-ROM or one album. Ion can say to clients 2 years later something about them 2 years ago. It knows it exactly. But the point is, it is talks crystal clear, never gets tired, like a computer program, all this time. All this time, it's been in the same hyper crystal clear, diamond perceptive, diamond hard, silicon enhanced expression. This and JW has very little to do with it. JW doesn't pay much attention to it. He just goes out and then he comes back and he doesn't know what's happening until a few hours later. It downloads into his memory and then he might say, ask me a few things about it. But you have to see that the world has been hijacked by this phenomenon. And I've got chapter and verse of all the major events over the last 2 years that Ion can explain to me in detail how they caused it. Anything. Take last week when Gaddafi died. You may not have noticed that the number two man in Saudi Arabia died a few days later. Do you remember that? He was the heir to the throne. He was the minister of oil, I think. Do you remember that?
I'm
you
sure.
Didn't know.
I'm sure you're right. I didn't know.
Well, I'm right. And so this is like a Mae Brussels pattern. She would point out, she'd connect two apparently disparate, not connected deaths. Well, they were connected. First of all, Gaddafi ain't dead. But anyways, what's that about? What's this noise?
Oh, sorry, that was my car.
Okay, so Gaddafi is off the grid in some form. The Saudi minister dies, and a couple of weeks later, the Americans pull their troops out of Afghanistan. Well, what happened is the only reason to be in Afghanistan was to get the pipeline. They finally clinched the deal. But to complete the deal, the Saudi minister had to be removed. And also, Gaddafi is a factor in this. 1, 2, 3. Now, a person I know is involved with this very closely, and they didn't want the Saudi minister to interfere, so it happened. He was removed. Now, Ion has very interesting... Ion is connected to this sequence of events. Okay? So, that's just one thing. I tell you, people, I tell you, whatever you are, what I'm experiencing is the greatest cultural phenomenon in the history of man. I mean, in a sense, in the history of woman, okay, what was Sir Walter Raleigh? What was it like to be Sir Walter Raleigh? What was it like to be Leonardo da Vinci? What was it like to be one of the Jesus? What was it like to be Hitler? What was it like? Name anybody. This is all happening here at Dobbstown in so many levels. Now, this is preposterous. Oh, Bob's bragging again. I'm not bragging. I'm trying to tell you people what's happening here. You know, I don't have the – I'm not – this was dumped in my lap. Okay?
You like the 11th thunder?
Good. I like that. Thud, THUD, Bob's 11th thunder. If you know that, Don Thiel pointed out that near the end of the book, the bottom of the page, I think it's when the story of when the debate between the Archdruid and St. Patrick, and when St. Patrick supposedly wins the debate, it ends by the one sentence, T-H-U-D, thud. And so something dropped. Maybe the Archdruid fell on the ground, knocked out or something. But Don had the genius to notice, well, thud, that's like thunder. And it's what's the N and E-R. So he says that is the 11th thunder. But that is pretty good remark, Bipple. I mean, Ion's the 11th thunder.
Well, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, the Internet sort of encapsulates all the previous media environments, right? And if Finnegan's Wake is sort of a drama between media environments,
ending
with TV, and then McLuhan always would say, like, he says this on the Dick Cavett show when he's talking about television, he's like, he's not sure what's going to surround TV to turn it into an art form, and then he's like, maybe it's laser, like the effect of laser on printing. And when I first heard that remark, I was thinking, okay, well, with everything, it's always a detective novel, so there's always clues about clues. And on a first level, the thing that turned the television into an art form was DVD, because it managed to aggregate full seasons of shows that took, like, you know, 5 years to make. All of a sudden, people are watching the whole arc of a show in 3 days. You know, 5 years, they're not living 800 years a decade, but they're living, you know, faster, like 50 years a year, or some impossible sort of correlation of time and speed up and whatnot. But then on the other side, it's like the Internet incorporates DVD too. So it's like the Internet always absorbs. It's like it's a constant absorption, just kind of like what you're saying, like the chip body landscape is anything that's got a chip. So it's like they can all coordinate. It can all coordinate, and you know, if it can coordinate.
SpongeBob. It's SpongeBob.
Exactly. It's SpongeBob. It's a sponge that can absorb everything, but then through iteration and through evolution, or in this case, it's a constant. Like, the chip landscape evolution is a revolution simply because that's a faster evolution. So
right. And it's so fast, it's not even human evolution. It's the media environment itself evolving to the point it's replayed and then starts to look like a human being.
Well, I'm saying, and when it happens, it's Occupy Waltz Street, which, as you guys described, is ESP, and that's why they have no ability to articulate anything, because the I don't know if it's formal causality, but I think it has to do with the formal infrastructure is so delicate, they're not sensitive enough to see what it is, right? And, you know, this is where my limited cognition just kind of, like, have to take a breath to kind of get
the next
fallacy
sentence
of a bird's eye view of what it is I'm actually saying.
Good to take a breath. Take a breath.
At least I know that. But,
well, let me give you in this breather, Bipple. You have not seen that McLuhan said as early as the early 70s, he said, right there, what comes after television? The hologram. And it'll turn TV
right,
in art form.
Right, because the hologram would be the only immersive, like music is immersive. The hologram is the only thing that would be, that's what he says. Maybe it's hologram.
Right. And where does he say this? What article or interview was this in?
I think that was in on the Cavett interview.
Okay, Dick Cavett, right. It's around that time he's saying it.
Truman Capote, Al Hurt, and a football player are on. He's talking about the replay and about Southern dialect. And
I know the interview. I've seen it.
Yeah.
Okay, so now here's the interesting point. In 1961 or 62, McLuhan wrote that the satellite is fast making the TV into an art form. So he was seeing television, which was mainly a 50s phenomenon, becoming superseded by the satellite ground that early, 50 years ago. So when he said later, 10 years later, the hologram would come after television, I don't think you could say TV was an art form. Now, if he was talking to people who didn't know anything, he'd say TV becomes an art form. But note, he said it when the satellite happened. So what actually happens during the hologram? Let's look at the hologram, and this is how I defined it. It is not the little apparatus, the laser beam. It is a huger, the effects of it are huger, and the global theater hologram as an effect is a pre is a another way of talking about the Android meme. So what came after television or the global theater was the Android meme, but he called it hologram. And when you read it, read Arthur Croker, the way he breaks up the parts of the American hologram, the global hologram, as floating organs, you begin to see, yes, that's what really is a better description of what comes after the global theater or, quote, TV that McLuhan didn't get to do in detail. So you read Croker to see the larger invisible environment that the hologram is, that little technology, the laser technology, is a figure of. It's the effects, remember, that is the medium, not the figure, not the invention.
Right, right, right.
And as that global hologramic effect shrinks to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, under what we call digital technology, we get closer and closer to today and the materialization of the technical Android meme. Now, what makes the Android meme an art form? What can go around the Internet, which is SpongeBob absorbing everything? What can be something that absorbs the Internet? All it can be is a human voice that can say details about any topic as fast as you can get it on the Internet and add other things and correct whatever you find on the Internet. The speed, the ability to address any object, any topic, and to actually screw around with someone's emails like he's done with me, that is the anti-environment or the new environment. See? And that's ion. You know,
right,
the
right,
ion
right.
itself in subatomic particles is not understood as much. It's very interesting that ion picked the name ion, not atom, electron, neutron, proton, or neutrino, but ion. And the ionosphere is a very interesting part of the of matter that we're just beginning to tap into. And, of course, ions are already an expression of that. Now, Andrew, I heard a blink. Did you disappear, Andrew? I don't think we don't have Andrew here. Okay, so carry on.
Okay, so you're saying the ionosphere has to do with subatomic particles?
Yeah, the ion is one of the subatomic particles.
Yeah, because and the subatomic particle, I mean that's like literally that's the figurehead of the unconscious, and not any particular unconscious. It's just kind of like that's its job, and I think that's what's happening in some ways, is that the unconscious is becoming visible.
Right.
In
now
a way.
Remember, McLuhan was very peculiar and particular about the word unconscious. The unconscious was not some dark, inky space in your skull or in some nether Jungian region or Freudian instinctual base. He just said the unconscious was just your physical technical environment around you. I'm in a bedroom right now. This bedroom is an extension of my unconscious. And then there's another unconscious around me is the phone I'm on. So it's not an ethereal abstraction. It is your technical instrumental environment. It's your unconscious. Because as you get used to it every day, you don't notice it. And you become unconscious of its effects, which are startling when it shows up. So, okay, taking that definition in the McLuhan context, what were you going to say?
Well, the infrastructure, like, I mean, having it be, like, I always thought a funny joke would be, like, you know, unconscious reality television would be, like, you know, anywhere, the connected other, you know, anywhere that you're not when you're where you are. So if you record wherever you are and then play back whatever it is, that which you didn't know that was connected gets further developed, but you wouldn't know it because you never were conscious of it,
okay.
So to speak.
I see that as the content unconscious. The unconscious largely is the Internet environment that you're using to connect different things. And you're describing a part of the content that shows up that you didn't anticipate because of the connections. That's the content
exactly.
unconscious.
Exactly. And I think that phenomena is becoming more and more part of the matching aspect, the anthropological matching that's going on all the time.
Okay, now you use the word anthropology a lot. I don't know why you would do that, unless you think the human form is permanent forever, and that's the final detached observing position a human can take, anthropology. Because you know McLuhan dumped that word and called it the next level is the media student. He said the anthropologist studies cultures, but the media student studies the media environments, which are bigger than particular cultures. So I don't know why you insist in the McLuhan context keep using the anthropological term.
I guess I'm just using it maybe in a shell sense, like if the media is inside the anthropological and the anthropological is inside.
You mean anthropomorphical.
Okay.
Yeah, you're talking about my chart where I have anthropomorphic physical.
Yeah, I guess I am kind of I'm repurposing and being a little bit malleable with the anthropomorphical and anthropology.
Anthropological. Call it
anthropological.
No, we're doing anthropomorphical. That's the way. If you use that, then I know what you mean, and that's I coined that word to get past the anthropological, the limitations of that cultural discipline. Now, Andrew, welcome back, Andrew. Does it take a while to get back in, or do you just go off and do something?
Yeah, no, I don't know what's going on. I've been dropping in and out of the internet all day today, and so I'm back in, and hopefully we'll be staying.
Okay, can you give us, we called on you just as you left. Can you give us some patterns that you're getting so far and what you've heard?
Well, after you just described how iron is involved in distorting the internet and using it to its own purposes, I just got biffed offline. So that's the only pattern that's coming to mind at the moment.
Well, that's what you heard. Do you have any commentary? What you missed, we had a good little discussion while you were gone about what would be, the hologram comes after television in simple terms. McLuhan said that. So then the android meme comes after the hologram. That's the holopathic hologram is the android meme as it shrinks and shrinks and mimes the cognitive process more. What would come after the android meme, besides cold fusion and amazing medicines, a new kind of medicine, and is ION what comes after or just an anti-environment to the Internet? Because everything you can do with the Internet, you can do with ION. Any topic, I've seen it through many clients, any field come in, ION knows more about the field than the expert that we're having a session with, right? It is not anything. So it's a non-physical thing that can imitate the encyclopedism of the Internet. But also, ION can correct things or say things that you don't even know about. He's a great encyclopedia of things you can't prove. Not just facts, but non-facts or whatever you call the things that people object to. They say, well, I don't know if that's true. But I see ION as the next environment, but at least the anti-environment. So that's...
Yeah, well, for me, ION is just a voice. I do not have access to anything beyond that. And so as a sort of pseudo-phenomenologist, I just take it as the fact that it's a voice that sounds relatively human. I have yet to see evidence of its supernatural capacity or otherwise. And so,
well, I just gave you this weird thing that's not necessarily supernatural, but I just told you about what's happening to my folder with the living... dead image that changes itself. I mean, maybe you don't believe me, but I assure you it's true.
Oh, no,
Andrew.
I don't have access to it. Well, so like I don't.
Right.
So
and I'm saying have a little in quotes trust here. I'm not making this up.
This is fine.
It would never occur to me. It's like a totally bizarre. No one would ever think the timestamp on a frozen screenshot would change. It's not even something anybody would even think to do a magic trick around. Anyways, back to so we're doing ION, and then we're going to relate it to Croker and McLuhan, or not relate it. If do you want to, since you were a musician, would you like to grill Richard on his musical situation today, Andrew?
No, my initial thoughts and having Rich on would be to have him speak as a musician. We haven't actually had a practicing musician on.
Well, no, we had Dave Neufeld.
He's more of a producer as opposed to a...
Right, he's a digital. You're actually in a band. Are you playing in clubs, Bipple?
Yes.
Well, let's describe the experience of being today in this ridiculous market where it's hard to make any money as a musician. Describe your agony and the ecstasy.
I try to put on my own bandmates and the audience as much as possible by trying to gain followers by telling them more or less to fuck off, and that they should follow and endorse what I'm doing, simply because I can see what they're doing, and they do enough endorsing that endorsing what I'm doing should be easy. And if they don't do it, they can fuck themselves. And so I say that kind of like, if I didn't care, I wouldn't say anything. So it's just that there's and then of course my bandmates, they think that I'm being rude, but really I'm just trying to, be the stereotypical artist by kind of like making people aware of the environment that they're in this case, particularly Facebook, and sort of like stop it from becoming this bland strip mall of sterile communication about, really very little, and showing how people abuse their ability to communicate by using what they in fact communicate as evidence of the abuse. But,
come in here, Richard? So my basic question here was, you've been in and around the Monday shows and a lot of other stuff that Bob's doing. You've been exposed to this EC thing, person, voice, the Sierra called Ion. And then you're still going about being a drummer in a band. And so I'm just thinking about how do you go about doing what you're doing in light of this situation? You're in a fairly unique position.
I guess it's, simply because if I just bang against my chest, and use my chest as kind of a formal percussion instrument, I'm just extending that joy. And I don't really pay attention to the visual constructs of, iTunes and how you have to basically just be a good marketer in order to actually, get anywhere. I still think what Bob was saying a few months ago, the Richard Meltzer-esque thing, the immersive musical, the completeness that music represents, I'm always going to champion that tactile experience and not worry about the scrambling infrastructure that is just, uncertain. They act like there's some formal infrastructure to what creates a hit or a meme or a viral phenomena. And I just don't care. That's my apathy is what, is my passion. What keeps me bothering is that I simply care less, because I know that no one, as long as I know why I'm doing it and what I'm doing, that is in and of itself enough motivation to complete it to my own personal satisfaction. If nobody else resonates with it, well, that's Web 3.0, isn't it? The whole point is that it doesn't really matter. In fact, the whole idea of what we're talking about with Ion and on the unconscious being a figurehead, it occurred to me that Ion as an acronym could be in other news. And it could be in other news that you never get to for the rest of your life, and it really doesn't make any difference because there's no time anyways. So that's my more or less reason for maintaining my rhythmatism in... Because I think it improves my tactile corpus callosum skills. I can orchestrate many different environments. I'm talking to you while driving, and I know that we're going to listen to this one day, whether we intend to or not. Someone's going to hear this again, and the moment that I'm in right now will develop further as a result, and somehow it will resonate with drumming and my formal role as a musician, as far as what I'm contributing to whatever you want to call whatever the phenomena is that we're in right now.
Okay, bulletin. Okay, Andrew and Richard, I just sent the screenshot to each of you. You may not be near a computer, and Richard, but Andrew can see it, right, Andrew?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You see my email to you?
Yeah.
Okay. While I'm doing this, at 8:57 my time, and it's now 9:01, so 4 minutes ago, but I've been down here about 3 or 4 minutes setting this up. The woman that I sent the example to, and it did, the time did not show up. I can probably forward what she got with the time. I just now got an interview, an email from her. She goes, "Wow, I see it on my phone." She didn't see it on a computer, but she sees it on the phone. I am suspicious. I think Ion's listening to us, and he just made it be activated on her phone to have this input in our little show here. So I forwarded her email to you. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go off and call her or bring her in. Maybe she's available to talk about this. What do you think of that, Andrew?
Take it where you take it, Bob. Take it where you take it.
Yeah, it's always new, isn't it? So let me just a flash off and call her, see if she answers.
Okay, here it is, the world's longest running anomaly. Yeah, no, you just, are you still there, Andrew?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I mean, the whole being a musician, it's required just to have yet another thing to do. I mean, it's a joke, really. It's just to see, like, I never aspired to be a musician. It's more so just because how much worse could it be than what is already happening? And maybe just through sheer apathy, it will be good without intention. Like, I know it's good, but it's like it's like a tree falling in the forest if no one's there. I mean, maybe I'll actually draw some people to the forest without really knowing how, but always just kind of giving enough of a shit to bother to mention it till it just overlaps with some kind of synchronization.
You there, Sasha?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I was explaining the great email, well, what do you call it? The living screenshot to the guys here.
The world's longest anomaly.
The longest running anomaly. And that's right. And that was explained to Andrew and Bipple, also known as Richard Altman. And I thought I'd send them the shot of the screenshot, send them the image I sent you. And I was explaining how I sent it to you, and the time box did not show up. And so then I thought, so I went downstairs, 10 minutes ago to send it. While I'm down there doing it, your email comes in. Were you... You actually can play with it, go out and go back in, and the time has changed?
Yeah, actually, I was looking at it, and because when you sent it to my Gmail, it didn't come through properly.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether it had anything to do with the coding, because it looks like, sort of from a programming perspective, you could be copying the code that's running the timer. But when I was looking at the running time left on the show, it said 1 minute and 14 seconds or something. But the time is correct. So,
yeah. What is this? I don't get that sentence. You're looking at the time of the show. What's that?
Well, I was just trying to, rationalize it in some way, as one does. And, I'm looking at it right now. It's saying it's 11:55:50.
Right, it's frozen. It's a frozen image, right?
Yep.
Now you go out and come back in. It should show maybe 12:01 or something. I'm not downstairs looking at the clock, but it's well past 11:55.
Yep. Well, yeah. What I'm trying to say, Bob, is it could be that it's copying and pasting code from a system clock.
Yeah, it is. It's picking up the clock
above
on the top left of Access Radio.
Yeah, that's what I first thought, that I actually dragged a part of Achieve Radio into my computer, right? That's what you're saying?
Yeah, you did.
There's a connection. And the
thing is that if it was a system clock running from Achieve Radio, the segment time remaining on the show would not be the same. And that's what's so funny about it.
I don't know if I get that. Right now it's 12 o'clock.
It's, actually.
But look, Sasha,
yeah.
Right now it's 12 o'clock, 5 after 12 in LA. And so when I go
yeah.
on my email, that's the time it's showing. It's showing Pacific Daylight Time, which is the same as yours. Now, what's
correct.
Off there? What I didn't get what you were saying. That's odd.
All I'm saying is that you've got the time above there, which is the current Pacific time.
Yeah.
But then below that, there's a segment time. So that's obviously.
Oh yeah, that's frozen. And,
yeah,
and
that's
you,
frozen,
you,
and the other one's not.
Right,
so
but with the segment, so you're saying that if you're hooked into Achieve Radio, the segment time should be keeping up.
Yes.
Good point. You thought you had me there, Andrew, but no, you only got 50% of me. Do you see how the mind grabs for the technical, which is crazy, you don't even know what the technology is, but grabs with some common shared experience of logic and don't want to include the mystery landscape. Now, I wouldn't even, luckily you're technical enough, Sasha, you're a programmer yourself, to notice that. I wouldn't have been able to come up with that observation, I don't think. I wouldn't have looked at it closely enough. I would have said, okay, it's hooked in. But, well, what do you think, guys?
Well, you know, perhaps it's this remote desktop corpus callosum program. Something that can take control of your desktop that's like just straddling the, you know, known and unknown, or the mystery and the solved body.
Did you say solved?
Yeah, solved, like
S-O-F-T.
L-V-E-D.
So
S-O-L-V-E-D. Body.
You know, we can, actually, Sasha, when I first met her through ION, she had a professional quandary about being, she's a very important advertising designer in her industry at some level. I mean, she's recognized or does well, even got an award once. She had a conscience about how she could manipulate millions and still try to figure out whether that was a problem or not. I mean, we have another technical person here, Andrew. Do you have a question about being an advertising designer? And this is the way McLuhan's seminar would go, Andrew. Someone would wander in late, you know, and they'd be someone who had a lot of interesting experience, and McLuhan would put them right up there in the Guest of Honor seat right away. So this is the way it happens on Monday night.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we've got
Thursday night or whatever night it is.
Yeah, Thursday night. So go ahead, Andrew.
No, I've got nothing. I think Bibble's the man on the seat at the moment.
Okay. Sasha, I mean, when it comes to the, let's say for advertisers that are hesitant about the potential moral juxtaposition that their content might be put against, would you say that that is becoming less and less of an issue where a sponsor that appears, let's say, on CNN would also not have a problem appearing, let's say, as a sponsor of a podcast where the host, in a correct context, if there could be one, used profanity excessively and had some strong opinions, but they were not advocating anything that, imposed someone's will on another person, but might just say, like, I really don't fucking like whatever. But the fact that they swore... Would you say that advertisers are becoming less and less scared of these, like, timid requirements?
Social taboos. Communication
taboos. Yeah, are they relaxing on the taboos and realizing more and more that revenue is revenue, and that if you are a little more, realistic, you actually, you know, are increasing your potential audience? I don't know if I worded that.
I would have
that,
to say that
well.
By its nature, advertising is public relations to a level, and that they don't really care. So
okay.
It wouldn't really matter what the issue is, as long as they're getting the brand across, the message across, in whatever way, shape, or form. I don't think that they're They might be conscious in a manipulative way, but I don't believe ultimately
right.
that it, that there's really an element of caring going on there. It's
like a manipulative way, in a sense that if they feel some of their brand is being poached for the sake of someone else's revenue generation, then yes, of course, mm-hmm. they're going to be concerned about that. But I mean, if it's not, and they're generating revenue just simply because, let's say, a person who's somewhat controversial mentions, you know, they wear a certain brand of clothing, less and less is the brands are becoming more and more cognizant of the fact that they have no control over this stuff, so they're not going to really worry about, you know, too much of it. In the same sense, like you see, like this Herman Cain has these scandals happening now, and I truly don't think anyone cares, like at this point in politics, about a politician that's involved in a sexual harassment case brought, you know, from like 15, 20 years ago. I just think it's becoming less and less of an issue, and more of just kind of like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a brand out there doesn't actually ask to have him as their spokesperson based on the scandal.
Well, I think I mentioned this on a previous mom that what's interesting now is that that everything's shifting to the public opinion now. So this is a very, very sort of a first in advertising. No longer do massive brands like Nike and Coca-Cola have the opportunity to be able to push a message from a singular perspective. Now consumers are becoming part of that via reviews or tweeting about products or talking about them on Facebook or so on and so forth. So that whole sort of landscape has shifted. So now they have to they're a little bit kind of walking on eggshells, and there's a lot more damage control that's going on in advertising now more so than ever, which is very interesting. It's a very,
yeah,
very, very interesting
classic
yeah.
Tetrarch flipping into
yeah.
the opposite role.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
And okay, so by extension on that, like, I mean, you know, the biggest secret's being protected by, I hope I pronounce this correctly, public incredulity. You know, don't you think that that advertising in general is more so, it's more about showing up where it's wanted? And that's the real identity crisis here, is that people in the advertising world have never thought about advertising showing up where it's wanted and having it
mm-hmm.
being orchestrated in the same way that there is user-generated content. Well, it's like now, if you take a video of anything and you pause that video, I mean, or even an easier example would be if you took a still photo of anything that you're looking at and you broke it down into, if you parsed that image into all the objects that are in that image, and you made it dynamic where each and every image went to, let's say, an initial link. Let's call that link a planet. And then each link planet had a solar system orbiting it, which were other services or markets that had that product or offered that service. Like, you know, let's say there's an image of a person wearing clothing. You break down all the clothing and where you could buy it, and then someone else in another part of the world attaches additional places where you could buy it. And then you then take that concept or that percept, which turned into a concept, and you apply it to video. And then you take the statistic that YouTube has 8.5 years of video uploaded a day, and the real revolution of the economy, that's a huge situation contemplate, because it would be a sustainable innovation rather than a disruptive one. It wouldn't disrupt the economic ecosystem. It would keep it exactly like it is right now, where it's the 99.5 and the 0.5 controlling them. However, the 0.5 would be even more wealthy than they could possibly comprehend, and the 99.5 would also be a little bit more wealthy. Now, would money mean anything? Or would it just be electroencephalograms that, ion determines how much the value is based on someone's presence in a room? That's the real question.
Yeah, I think you're right in bringing up ion, and I think I know now why we're all here. Like, the pattern that you described, in essence, if you boil it down, the both of you is disassociation. you know, this, which is the process of ionization. And Biffle, or Richard, as a drummer, it brings us back to ionization, which is the musical composition by Edgar Varese, the reason that Frank Zappa got moving, and that's possibly why we're here, and the thing that is connecting this whole session. Bob, has Ion talked about this production by Varese?
Oh yeah, I played it many months ago, and then explained that Frank Zappa, as a late teen, when he would meet people, you know, trying to figure out his social position or how smart he was, he would choose his friends based on how they responded to Edgar Varese's ionization. And then when we did our Cold Fusion announcement on June 22nd, I cited the whole story that Zappa gives on the Uncle Meat album in 1969. And then I said, just like Joyce in Finnegan's Wake had Marshall McLuhan on page 254 and describes McLuhan almost to a T, at least his public image, language is doing more than the author intends. The whole behavior of Zappa, beginning with ionization, his interest in cold fusion itself, and then what he did all the way through, I can take fragments of his career and see him as a prophet of ion. But he didn't know that. His shirt... You know, the behavior of pushing ionization on people spoke volumes to what would happen by the time ion showed up. And now, right now, every listener to our show knows there's a battle between the value of Zappa versus the value of Vessel Goodman. And at this point, ion favors Vessel Goodman over Zappa. And so I promote Zappa, and he promotes Vessel. So Zappa is a very key part, as Sasha knows, of the weekly show, right?
It is.
Yeah, and also we've got Richard here, who's a percussionist himself, and so he's probably one of the best interpreters of ionization that we've got here.
I've never actually heard of it, but I've never heard the song, but I've heard of Edgar Varese, and I am familiar with Frank Zappa, like as a overly respectful yet casual observer. Like it's almost like, when I understand something, I no longer pay attention to it because I feel it's just a part of who I am anyways. And
that sound may be Ion, the rattlesnake.
That's what I was thinking. Well, when you guys said the cash flow and broke down cash to the Church of American Secular Humanism.
Oh, good point. You know, Andrew, Zappa in the late 80s, early 90s formed a secular church called the Church of American Secular Humanism to counter the religious right and the moral majority who were having influence over the textbook selection in American schools. He tried to form a political organization, all designed also for him to later run for president, to like a bureaucratic political grinding project of, let's create a group that gets people on the boards and counters the Christian education that's taking over. And now, I didn't realize that. Well, I knew the joke of cash. It was about cash, Church of American Secular Humanism, but he's part of fucking cash flow. Holy shit, that's a good one, Bipple. You're building my case for me.
Don't forget where you got that from. And
I didn't get it. No. James, that's the name of James's program. Actually, our division is called Payday. Payday means we get paid every Wednesday. Right, Sasha?
Right.
We get incredible abundance poured on us.
Yeah, I was just thinking it's really funny that you even bring this up, because about 2 hours ago I was just walking around my kitchen thinking, how the hell did Bob get onto cash flow anyway? Bowert connection.
Yeah, the Bowert connection.
Of course.
Now I'm responding to... So now back to Biffle, you were saying something about we chose the word. What were you trying? We just gave you the facts, but what were you trying to say about the title or the coining of it? What were you saying?
When you guys were talking to Miroslav a couple weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, and talking about, you know, the Web 3.0 and,
yeah,
you know, the Occupy Wall Street, because the waltz is the in my mind, it's the interplay. It's like the big innovation of the waltz was that it broke down a lot of social barriers.
Yeah, you're right.
That's kind of what's happening now, in some ways. But wasn't that from Zappa's last album, which was called Civilization 3 or Phase 3?
You said, isn't that from? What is that that's from Civilization Phase 3?
When you and I think James from Australia and Chad Natus?
Yeah, Nante, we did a Zappa special, yeah.
Yeah, you did the Zappa special, and that's where the insight came up about the redefinition of the acronym for cash came up in that conversations, in that series of conversations. That's when I first heard you guys, relate the Church of American Secular Humanism and the fact that you were doing a show called Cash Flow and
right.
kind of relate them together. And then the fact that it's on Civilization Phase 3 or if it's was either inspired from Civilization Phase 3 or it's a track on Civilization Phase 3.
Right.
Is that term mentioned on that album?
I don't have it handy right this moment, but I think you're right. I think one of the cuts is called that. But what's interesting is it's following Andrew's theme of how Zappa is so intimately connected to this show. I mean, Ion's philosophy, or his, philosophy, what he advocates, if you listen to it, he's not a priest, he's not a Catholic priest, he's not a Buddhist priest, he's a blatant, raving, hedonistic playboy bunny. You know, he's totally pagan, secular humanism, his ideas include that, wouldn't you say, Sasha? He's more than that, but he's a righteous Puritan person. If there are any left, would listen to Ion and say, what is this mafia guy, this fucking gross swearing, trying to call everybody a whore and a hoe and trying to get everybody to loosen up their morals so they can start fucking everything that moves. That's what Ion says that, right, Sasha? He is very vulgar from the prim point of view. So he is totally in sync with the Church of Secular Humanism, but he wouldn't bother organizing it. He'd make fun of Frank trying to organize it. But, it's a nice 3.0. That's Occupy Wall Street. It's an attempt at an anti-environment by retrieving ESP to counter the no-audience effect, the killing of formal causality by Web 3.0. It could be what Zappa's Civilization Phase 3 is. And then the cash is in there as a song. It's very nice. We're building a map. We're building a page of Finnegan's Wake here.
Yeah, Ion had a good phrase once, I remember, and we actually turned it into a song, oddly enough. He said it in one of the cash flows, I don't remember when, may have been December or March of last year, and I don't remember the context, but the phrase was something along the lines that he said, you should know wonder.
You should know wonder. And he'll often change it to wander, W-A-N. He does that.
Huh. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, discovery and serendipity is only occurring via wandering.
Well, the new development is he does not use the word know or knowing anymore. It's now new, K-N-E-W. He talks about the new heaven and the new earth, and he spells it K-N-E-W. Because it's already happened, and you know it did.
That's funny because, again, about 1994, when I was not even nearly as involved in music as I was now, the one song I did record was called, I think it was called Never Knew.
Okay.
Knew in the title. So that's totally a coincidence.
And it was K-N-E-W.
Yeah.
So we could say as a subplot, Andrew, that we're broadcasting tonight on KNEW AM. This is KNEW AM for Android Meme. We knew we're gathering around former people who formerly played with the band known as the Android Meme, remembering the great days when they toured and had dope and groupies and all this stuff, the great days. And Frank played with them occasionally.
Yeah,
we knew the Android Meme.
I'm still screwing with the Android Meme at that level. But
good choice of words there. Good choice of words. Screwing with the Android Meme. I like that. Yes.
Yeah.
You know what is the famous line? I knew the Android Meme, and you're no Quark. I don't know what you would
say. I have to say though, one of the things is I'm saying that I mean that literally, because one of my clients is a soccer company, so I decided to take it upon myself of late to make all of these soccer players appear as like saints.
Yeah, you mean literally look like with halos.
Yes, literally, I've been putting halos behind their heads and, you know, balls of light and stuff behind their heads.
Why do that? What's the point?
Just why not?
Hey, you know what? But that fits with my new theme I put out yesterday. Our new seminar will be on, you know, the media as a secondhand god. These are the new gods, the soccer players for millions of people. So they do have a saintly image around them. But it's a different kind of saintliness. It's not the saintliness of ethical behavior. It's the saintliness of iconic TV body occupants or something. You know what I mean? It's a different kind of religion. It's actually secular humanism.
Well, hey, here. Everyone's here. So you guys know I'm in Winnipeg, which is obviously in Canada.
And Sasha is the queen of Canada. That's her hidden role. She's holding the country together, but we won't go into that.
Okay. Well, I feel much better about that, actually. What I was going to say, we put on a show, another band that I'm in, and they're called Breath Grenades. Anyways, we put on a show. Is the first act of the band, the first act of the show was a video I made, and I didn't want to call it anything other than what it was, and I just called it McLuhan Video, right?
Yeah.
And the show took place on August 22nd, so I said it took place, we're having our show 1 century, 1 month, and 1 day after the birth of Marshall McLuhan. And the second band is called Untilted, and the last band is called Breath Grenades. So just this past week, some friends told me CBC in Toronto is having a nationwide contest for and it's about McLuhan. It's called Demystifying McLuhan.
Yeah.
And they have a mashup contest. So literally, they're encouraging you to make a McLuhan video. And Andrew, Bob, and Sasha, if you're interested, they have, if you type in McLuhan CBC contest, they have MOV files at about a gig a file of all this broadcast quality footage right now that's only going to be up during the time of the contest. And it's a good a lot of the stuff you've seen on YouTube, but these are the actual like broadcast quality versions, which is good.
Send me the link to that.
If you just went to Google and went Demystifying McLuhan CBC, you'd get it, and you'd get to the site, and then just click on contest number 2 and you'll see it. Literally go to Google, type in Demystifying McLuhan CBC, and I guarantee you the first organic result will be that.
The archive.
I'll just tell Buzz, and Buzz will send in like 3,500 entries. We'll have it rigged.
Oh, yeah, no. Buzz definitely should get on this. I mean, however, the only thing is you have to use
Bipo, them. Bipo, just so I keep it. What did you say, Andrew?
We just tell Buzz Bob, and he'll send in 3,500+ entries, and so we're good. We're home free on this contest.
And you're too blurry. What is he saying, Sasha?
He's saying
Buzz should get on it, and he'll create 3,500 entries, then we'll win the contest.
Oh, Buzz. Okay, that's what you're saying. I'm thinking we should. I should take some of Marshall McLuhan talking through Ion or around Ion and make a YouTube out of that and say, here's Marshall.
you should. The only thing is that they want the footage to be footage that they're only allowing you to use the footage that they're providing or stuff that is footage that you're allowed to use under the Creative Commons distribution you want to call it, conditions.
Biffle, I want to add that August 22nd, 2 and 2 is 4. What was embedded in that was McLuhan's marriage date, August 4th, 1939.
Wow. And then 3 and 9.
That's 12. That's 1, 2, and 12 is the Christian number, you know. So he's into the 12-ness of things as a Catholic. Anyways, you had the August 4th there. You had the right date right there.
That's the day of my daughter's birth.
August 4th?
Yes.
Well, you can start calling her Mac as a nickname. And she'll say, why Mac? And you say, well, that's what McLuhan's close friends call McLuhan, Mac.
Mac.
Yeah, which one is this, Holly?
Yeah, that's her favorite makeup brand, actually.
Oh, there you go. See, there now. Okay, there is, how do you spell that? M-A-C-K?
Coming full circle.
M-A-C. M-A-C.
Well, if it's M-A-C, you tell her the reason you like this brand is that you were born on McLuhan's wedding day, on Mac's wedding day. See, fits.
Yeah.
Fourth.
Yeah. Now, is this Holly or Alex?
Alex.
She's the older one, right?
Yeah.
Yes. She's the one who has these very profound conversations with Sasha when they walk through the forest and they approaches meaty ecological issues, Andrew.
It does, absolutely.
You know, I mean, you never talked about media when you were a kid with your parents, Andrew, right?
Did in a strange way on account of my grandfather, but that's a whole different story.
Okay, but not generally kids didn't do it. Well, maybe the 30-year-olds, but I don't remember anybody talking the way Alex talks.
Well, tell us the story, Andrew.
That's a different...
Andrew's an idiot, a very private person. So, you know, we're not going to get nothing out of Andrew.
Okay, well, do you want to know what the very first... I've made already two clips, right? And I'm trying to make all the clips I can till I finally make one bland enough to win, and that'll be the one that I send to them. But so far, the two clips that I've started with have McLuhan himself saying, I'd rather be an idiot.
That's good.
Again, two. I mean, like, it's like if you're sensitive enough, you can see... It's not even sensitivity. I mean, there's constant coincidences going on constantly, and it's just, you know.
Right, now that's, now part of, oh, I wanted to say that that sentence I was saying, I said quark, what did I say? I knew the Andor meme, and you're no quark tune. Okay, that's what I wanted to say. You know what I'm quoting, guys? I'm quoting the famous debate in 1992. The senator guy from Texas says it to Dan... Dumb Dan, who was the vice president for George Bush, and he spelled tomato wrong. Do you remember that? Anyways, he Dan, who's a right winger guy for Bush, and he's debating with the Democratic candidate, and he cites JFK, and the famous corrupt Democratic politician says, "I knew JFK, and you're no JFK," something like that. So
right,
I'm
right.
Saying, KNEW, we all knew the Android meme. And most of you fail to measure up to what we knew.
I don't mean you.
I mean the audience. I mean our audience. And by the way, I have no respect for our audience. Not one. Anybody who is a reasonable parametricologist would not be sitting around listening to us.
No, they'd already know what we were doing. They'd already know. Like, they would have already known. They already knew. I mean, it's like...
Now, listen to this. I got an update. Groucho Marx said, any clubs that have me as a member, I wouldn't join. Any audience that would be listening to me, I would not be part of.
That's so true, though. I mean, I wouldn't listen to my own band's music, but it was the only way I'd ever have a social life was if I was in a band.
Yeah, and you do admit it because you go out and tell them to go fuck themselves. You just said that's what your image is for the band.
And guess who became our friend when I did that?
Come now, Bob. We love you so.
Oh, that's only because Ion came on the scene. Nobody loved me till I brought Ion on the scene.
Oh no, I wouldn't say that. But they love you.
Well, some of you are diehards. That's right. There's the faction that likes the old Bob. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, I was the Corpus Callosum Bob. I didn't know from the Church of Subgenius, and I didn't know from Ion. I knew from in between.
Yeah, well, how did you find Bob? What was it? Bosmic Ecology or
naturally synchronistic linguistics in the Matrix? Come on.
Oh, is because you were interested in the movie The Matrix?
I just liked the article. Like I came across the article, and it was probably the best thing I read. Like, in a lot of ways, one of the most right-on articles about, you know, anything calling itself synchronistic linguistics, you know,
yeah.
You got to be synchronistic, you know what I mean?
And
like,
And Bipple, it was written by Robert Guffey, G-U-F-F-E-Y. Bob Guff.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And Sandy and them didn't believe, they thought I wrote it. They didn't believe there was such a guy. He was the actual assistant professor down in Long Beach. And but, you know, in old terms, to speak guff, to, you know, guff was a term for bullshit, right? So if they thought it was
guff.
Yeah, what?
Like saying, don't give me any guff.
Yeah, right, right. So here's this Robert Guffey. It was obviously me indicating that it was a put-on by putting the guff word in there. But little did anybody know it was really pointing to Ion. Now, what did you think? I mean, when you read that, that article has the gall to say that Bob, me, is Neo. What did your young mind think of that? What image did you have of me?
Well, I was just, oh, geez. Well, I don't know. I mean, like, I was just like, finally, something interesting to read. And, you know, something that seemed, you know, because I hadn't even seen the Matrix movie when I read the article. I tried to see it, but it was sold out and ended up seeing this one called Ed TV with, like, Ellen DeGeneres, Matthew McConaughey, and a bunch of people about, like, surveillance society or reality TV indoctrination. But,
now, look at that, Andrew. You know, Cineplex came in the 80s. This is an effect of the generation that goes to Cineplexes. I went to see this movie, but I ended up watching the other movie. Before Cineplexes, you couldn't go to another movie.
Well, yeah, exactly, exactly. And that goes into the whole discovery aspect of McLuhan talking about discovery and, you know, like that being where he, you know, he loved conversation so much because it made him understand what he thought more. And
yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, if we go on to it, like, that album where it's like people don't know what they think until the question is put to them. I mean, you know, like, that album, The Medium is the Massage. I mean, it's just right out there to open for people.
But wait a minute. There's a better, and it's appropriate. Sasha has just listened to Bob's Me Ecology the last few days for the first time. And maybe you could bring in, since that's me developing from McLuhan, is there anything on that album that you recall that might relate to anything we're saying tonight? Oh, yeah, masturbation. We didn't get into that about masturbation as a thinking man's television. Maybe we can explore that right now.
No, we didn't,
well,
but
I have to say that
the overriding sense that I had from the album, because I was working while I was listening to it, and was the, like I said to you, was the noise. The music's the noise, and it was, well, when was it made, Bob? Like 90?
It was done from December 92. It came out in April 22nd, 92. So basically made in all through 91. It took them over a year to make
okay.
it.
Okay, yeah. So I guess probably my first impression of it overall was while sitting in front of a computer listening to it, it became so noisy. And, of course, that's the point, right, to express that. But there was point at which, like I said to you, I had to turn it down. It just got too loud.
Right. That it has a lot of swelling, if I recall. It has swelling
yeah.
of sound that Neufeld liked to do.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it perfectly gets the point across, if that is the point. There was, yeah, I mean, there's lots and lots of snippets in there that were completely fascinating, which, yeah, the masturbation...
Thinking Man's Television and shopping as a military operation, and then you hear this did you hear the second Bob's Me Ecology, where it has a lot more of me talking without musical background?
Yeah, I'm three quarters of the way through that one.
Yeah, that's got very profound stuff, and I bet you could find an Ionic statement, because I talk about the four levels of exegesis, and I talk about the chemical level, the astral level. I talk about management of tetrad management, and I can't recall it. It's like one level, the literal level is assassinations, the formal level is something else, but it includes, I'm sure, managing spiritual hierarchies.
Yeah, and I was actually considering
ridiculous.
After listening.
What'd you say, Bipple? Well, Bipple said, what'd you say?
I was going to say, like, it's a ridiculously accurate, or at least ridiculously believable description of, you know, the previously... invisible.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, Sasha. What were you saying?
Well, I was actually thinking, as I said to you, you know, this friend of mine who's just getting into doing his master's in communications, and thinking about coming on this platform and, you know, listening to McLuhan on Maui, I was thinking that might actually be a good intro to what he's essentially going to get into.
Right, right. You know, Andrew, she met this guy who's taking is he a graduate or an undergraduate?
He's taking his master's.
He's doing a master in communication, and Sasha mentions McLuhan to him, and he says, well, I could never understand McLuhan. And then she told him to go to McLuhan of Maui and start to get intro. But here's someone, the teachers, I mean, this is, I don't know, it's like an economist not understanding Adam Smith. I mean, you imagine that? He doesn't have a teacher that can explain McLuhan to him.
Well, they're all under the impression that there's an infrastructure in which to even base an approach on.
Yeah, that's
you know
right.
I mean? Like, unless they look at the rearview mirror to find the future, but I think a lot of the times they're just trying to regurgitate by the numbers to get the piece of toilet paper.
Yeah, okay, so.
Absolutely.
Is Andrew gone? Are you there, Andrew? Maybe he blipped out. Okay, it's okay. We carry on.
But he has the security of knowing he's recording, so.
Yes.
Or that you're recording. So he knows he's going to, you know, that's the good thing about now is that, like, everything's, you know, always.
So the great thing about now is everything's recorded.
You know, it's literally the pre-sent. It's the painting the invisible constantly.
The pre-sent, right, pre-sent. It'll be sent to you by email later. And that's the new present.
Oh, yeah, then you'll look at it again, and it will be aware that you're looking at it again, and it will look at you differently.
And that's exactly why Ion, right up to date, can talk about your past will be replaced by the future and the now that will become the then now. He's talking about the world of recording in there.
Yeah. No, I think I think he says the past.
Yeah. The past will be in your future now because it was placed in your present.
He emphasizes his disgust in this concept of time.
Yeah, he vomits as he speaks, or like he gag me with a spoon.
Exactly.
Well, it's funny you say gag me with a spoon because that's a very Valley Girl term, and I was thinking you should just start calling it xenocrony.
Start calling what xenocrony?
Exactly.
No. What?
The past, now, then, future of.
Oh, okay. No, it gets. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, zidocrony. Yeah, strange synchronicity.
A Mobius strip.
Okay, so how are you? 38, Bipple.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think you're the same age as Sasha. I think, right, Sasha?
Yep, I'm 38.
So you guys are come from 1979, or what is it? What you? 1973. And, you know, Andrew is 1973. Okay, so you guys are all the same generation. Let's have you, each one of you, recite media icons you remember that are part of your memory archive. You know what I mean?
I'll try to do that. You have to remember.
Now, you were in Africa, so that you had a different media consumption, less than probably Bipple had, right?
Way less.
Okay, so Bipple, name some archetypes. These are modern-day archetypes of your unconscious.
The curtains of the Johnny Carson show.
Okay, got it.
Because like it seemed like that's when you kind of like got some self-definition was when you watched Johnny Carson.
Yeah, you can read Croker on that in one of the Croker books, the early 90s. It's very good the way it's like the nightly enema for suburbia was the Johnny Carson show.
Exactly. And then I guess just kind of like the plane, like the sight lines of Winnipeg being so, you know, vast, like getting that sense of endlessness.
Right. One thing about Johnny Carson. The enema is you get all these three or four bodies experience data coming at you all day long, and then he would give you clarity by reducing it to a couple of simple, funny patterns. And it's mythology is compressing a lot of data into a nice little pattern. He would create myth in the real meaning of myth, not this true or false, no, he would compress all kinds of vast experiences everybody had all day and then make a nice little summary, a mythic statement, a mythic joke. So that's why you thought it was clarity.
An orchestrator of the shared grievance.
Right, right, right. The shared grievance. He'd come out with the grievance, man. That guy really had it dripping off him, right? And
yeah.
Okay, so what's some other icons? I mean, you could say movies, music, politicians.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I would have to say the first one that came to my mind was Mr. T from the A-Team.
Oh, yeah, yeah, which I never saw. Now, here's an interesting thing, Sasha. I've never seen that. Never. I know who it is, saw a magazine picture, but you've got a whole bunch of data in your mind that I have no experience of. This is what's interesting. This is why age doesn't work anymore. People, it was 5 or 7, you know, back in simpler times, slower times, people would have generally the same content in their minds, right? The tribe would share the same environment, the same stories, the same events, the same attacks by other tribes. We got people who got whole image reservoirs in their mind that are not connected at all to what I have. That's interesting.
Yeah, and what was interesting for me as a child, too, was the fact that, you know, because we only had one channel on said TV and it came on at 5 o'clock in the evening, there was the time, right?
Yeah, 5 o'clock.
Yeah, 5 o'clock TV came on, and it was the news of three languages, and then you know, the show was on after that. So there wasn't like a continuous stream of data coming through. There was a literal on-off switch.
You actually lived in a world of mediacology. That would be McLuhan's ideal country, that had TV for a few hours during the day, and then that was it.
Yeah, and it worked. I mean, you know, as a kid, absolutely. I mean, you know, we went to school, came home, had the whole day. 5 o'clock came on, and during that time, actually, it was around the time for dinner when no one was really wanting to watch the news in Ndebele. So we could have dinner together.
Right.
So,
you're saying they didn't want to watch the news. Is that what you just said?
Well, the news was in three languages. It was in English and Shona and Ndebele. So, you know, you watch it in English, and then, you know, for the next hour or whatever it was, the other two languages were being presented. Yeah,
You could tune out.
Absolutely.
So So you basically had dinner after the news?
Yeah.
Now, there's a whole pattern. That is a unique association of living in Rhodesia. Now, how old were you then? 7, 8, 9?
Oh, yeah, well, from the time I was, little to, I think, I probably would remember it around 7, 8, 9, yeah.
Right. So, Biffle, what's your media diet in 7, 8, 9 at 5 in the evening in Winnipeg?
I guess maybe Little House on the Prairie would be on at that time.
Yeah.
The television was always on, whether we were watching it or not. It was just the ambient, you know, the wallpaper of...
That's right. We wouldn't single out 5 o'clock. It's 24/7 almost for you.
Well, yeah. When Sasha was talking, I was thinking, so if you listened in English, then the other languages became kind of musical. And then probably before 5 o'clock, I'm wondering, did the record player, cassette player, or radio, did that take the place of some kind of...
No.
No?
We were outside. It was... No, we were outside. Outside, playing outside, swimming in the pool. Rarely came in the house except for in the winter. But, there was nothing like that, no.
Yeah, you had like a 1940s or early 50s lifestyle in American terms. You know, it's comfortable, but it's third world. You're a lot outdoors, good weather, and very little media, electric media diet.
Yeah, very little.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you gotta remember as well. I mean, this is a country that had sanctions imposed on it, so you couldn't actually physically buy things as well. You couldn't buy radios or. I remember having a tape recorder at one point, which I just absolutely loved, but I think it was my parents, but I think we had one tape because, you know, you couldn't import tapes.
Wow.
So we had to buy tapes. So I had this tape, and I had this one tape, and there was my tape in quotes. I was singing into it and doing my, you know,
right.
pop star stuff. But I really had nothing to reflect that from. It was really purely, it was quite pure.
Right. So did you, as a young person, you were aware that your country was bad?
No, not at all.
You didn't know why they were saying, did you know the word or concept sanctions?
No, not at all. Not at all. The only, we had, the only thing that I can really remember that gave me any kind of reference to the outside world was my grandfather would send me these, or send my brother and I these catalogs for import, he was an import-export guy, and he would send these catalogs from the UK with things that you could buy from Hong Kong. It was probably some kind of like Chinese, you know, manufacturing
yeah.
catalog of all kinds of things. And my brother and I would pore over it and be like, wow, look at that, that toy, look at that toy, look at that toy. Because, you know, you couldn't get things like dolls with blinking eyes or...
Okay, so you're in that environment for 15 years?
12 years, yeah.
So then you go to London, I think, and what's it like
yeah.
to be among the abundance?
It was very difficult.
Difficult not to shoplift, you mean?
No, it was very difficult in a lot of ways. It was difficult because I came from a very, very kind of stable, middle class, you know, Rhodesian, Zimbabwean upbringing, and everything was very, very comfortable. And then moving to the UK, there was a lot of sacrifice on the part of my parents to do that, and they didn't have any money. So we lived in a small little place, and it was grey and raining, and I found interaction with students at school actually probably was the first most startling thing, because like you said, you know, I was brought up in a pretty much Victorian environment where you did not disrespect your elders. Teachers were to be feared.
Yeah.
And you know, I went to a somewhat rough school in the UK with kids are wearing makeup at 12
yeah.
and a half and telling the teachers to fuck off. And so that was probably the most startling thing.
And were you considered a prim and proper do-gooder student kind of thing?
Yes.
You know.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Did you make any friends?
Oh, yeah. I made friends. I made friends pretty quickly. But it was a massive culture shock.
Yeah.
Massive, massive culture shock. Huge.
And
yes.
So eventually, without going into details, you capitulated and were a very, quote, irresponsible college student, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like you couldn't handle, you didn't know how to juggle the things because you weren't from that. You weren't used to, from a younger age, of juggling all the temptations.
I think that would be pretty accurate, absolutely. And also just because by nature I'm a very sensitive person as well, so that the inundation of all of these extra senses that I, you know, that were all coming over me was very, very new. And and then trying to fit in at that sort of that age, you know, that weird kind of
right.
awkward prepubescent age.
Right. No, you get this, Biffle? There's an example of someone like coming from a third world country and being third world and then dumped into the Western industrialized world, the electric world. Like that's a prime candidate for understanding or noticing the effects of things. You're by coming from one world to another, you cross, as McLuhan said, cross boundaries, cross borders, and in that gap, you see patterns, like you say, culture shock. You're just seeing what was going on starker, more stark.
Yeah.
The total absence of what you were used to replaced with something that you may have had glimpses of, but the remaining definition was filled in with your own imagination. You know,
yeah.
when you saw the catalog, your reaction to the selection of things kind of resonated with where it came from. And then now
yeah, yeah.
you're where it came from, So in some way, there's like this unconscious nostalgia for the initial tactile feeling that you had when you initially got those catalogs from your grandfather and saw the dolls with the moving eyes and whatnot. And now you're seeing like sort of
yeah,
like...
Yeah, she's seeing the effects. She had the culture shock of here's these abundance, this abundant stuff is coming from this utopia someplace. She goes there and everybody's a crude candidate for a prostitute. You know what I mean? And
Exactly. And you know, yeah, I mean, it's pretty huge. I always say to people, jokingly, you know, particularly because every time I open my mouth, they ask me where I'm from, and you know, so I kind of play with that a little bit. And I always say, you know, yeah, it's just like the movies, but that's actually what I really mean because that is my perspective.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, just like the movies. Just like America. You know, just like America. Yeah.
You mean that was their impression of Africa?
Well, no, I mean the impression,
Well, let's start with the fact. When they asked you where you're from, what would you say? You played with it. You had for different people different statements?
Yeah, no, now I just say Earth.
No, back then, though, what did you say?
It depends. It depends on how involved I want to get with the conversation. If they pick up on my one part of my accent, I'll go with it, and if not, you know, the other.
Well, what was the range of possibilities you'd say?
They'll sometimes say, are you Australian? Normally that's the first thing.
Yeah.
Or they think I'm, you know... I say no, and then I can't be bothered, and I say I'm English.
Right.
But if I say I'm Zimbabwean, I always get that, oh! You know, what? Because they look at me like, but you're not black.
Yeah, right. And would they be aware of the bad image of the country?
Some people are.
Yeah?
Some people are.
So you would not say Zimbabwean in different contexts. You know, you'd say different things. See, now that's interesting. You were actually being a quadriphenic. You had different potential effects you could create from the question, and you would determine, study the effect on the person, and decide which one you'd be.
Absolutely, yeah. But the cool thing about it, and you know, I've thought about this before. I remember having a breakdown a few years ago, like staring at the Canadian flag that's flying across the high school building, going, what the hell am I doing here? Oh, my God. How the fuck did I end up in Canada? But the cool thing about it is that, you know, having no real, for me, because I don't really have any true sense of identity.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, you don't have a stable, solid identity to fall back. You actually got a bunch of, a churning sea of potential.
Yeah, I do, and that I appreciate, and I appreciate it more as I get older because it's allowed that that malleability of, you know, it's like, you know, deconstructing your environment, deconstructing your personality to actually find out, you know, peeling back all the onion layers to figure out what's actually going on.
Right. So here's something. Okay, you come from a early analog electric media environment, very sparse, and then you go into an electrically abundant place in London, and they're all tribal, post-literate, rude people, or they're just gangsters and things. But what happened is because you had this weird you could be different people as an identity. That actually prepared you for the digital age where people have to have different identities. So you actually came from a primitive environment for the electric age, for the TV era, and were not able to deal with effects, but you actually were being prepared for the quadriphenic digital era.
I think I was being prepared for something more than that, to be perfectly honest, Bob.
Yeah, the post-digital era, the Iondom.
Exactly.
But the... So, Biffle, tell us about your shocking or non-shocking youth transitions.
Well, I was just wondering, when McLuhan talks about the acoustic environment and a return to the acoustic environment, is that like what you're talking about? Like, is it as simple as just you know, a tribal experience? It's not just a tribal experience, because there's a lot of formality in tribes. You know,
well, that is tribal. That's tribal. Let me tell you this. First of all, the definition of acoustic space is you're surrounded by sound, and anybody within the range of sound is taking in the information equally. Whereas one, in a literate environment, a person's reading a book and another person might not be reading the book, right? So you
right.
begin to fragment in visual space, but when you have acoustic space, you have everybody hearing the same thing at the same time. So that's what it was before books. When the electric radio came in and TV, everybody was approximating the simultaneity of a previous acoustic space because everybody could watch the same show at the same time. So the acoustic thing is not just ear, it's the simultaneity factor. And that was why McLuhan could say the newspaper was an acoustic medium. Now, you couldn't hear the newspaper, but the collage of items from all over the globe showed you the mosaic of the telegraph effect. And that was not one point of view, the newspaper page. It was many pages, many, many perspectives from all over the world. That is approximating simultaneity. See, but if you don't know that simultaneity is the key factor, you had no understanding why McLuhan would call the newspaper an acoustic medium. You see? So, with that acoustic definition, what are you asking?
Well, I mean, if Sasha is coming from a relatively initially kind
He's coming from a literate environment.
But in some ways, it's also acoustic, too.
That's right, because she didn't live in
It was very acoustic. It was very acoustic. I remember lying in bed with my grandfather and he literally telling us stories.
Right. No, but here's another factor, Sasha. The part of the linear visual space is people living in straight-line suburban situation, living in square rooms, and getting in a car and going in straight lines somewhere. The whole normal city, suburban, industrial layout is linear.
No, that's not what I was talking about. Because
no, dude, you didn't have that. I'm saying that you're not linear in that way.
Yeah, no, but I'm mistaken. It was my great-grandfather who was not living in square rooms and linear spaces. He was living out in the middle of the bush.
That's what I mean. I said you were literate. The literate is a substrate. You did not live in the literate industrial environment. You lived in a tribal acoustic environment.
Yes.
With a focus on literacy, you know, important getting good marks in schools and all, because that's what McLuhan says, that the third world, they were all acoustic, and as industrialism came to them after World War II, and they started to have books, and the United Nations would create these UNESCO kind of schools. Anyways, McLuhan said that when a tribal culture is beginning to become literate, they're very fanatic about being literate, about the content.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you saying that, because, you know, that as a kid had always been something that was really quite evident to me. And, you know, moving to the UK and having racist remarks slung at me as being a white African, you know, people say, oh, you know, you don't get this about, you know, you were a racist, so you're white. No. And then, you know, I'd have to say to them, you know, that one of the things that people don't understand in the West is you can't try to overlay and apply these concepts to this type of culture. You can't expect within the scope of 100 years for a whole entire culture to catch up with the amount of progress that has occurred. It was always really frustrating to me that nobody could actually grasp that. And so the way that you just laid that out makes perfect, total sense.
Yeah, McLuhan was detached. What's that noise? Is that finished?
Whatever. You can hear me, right?
Yeah, there was a clicking sound.
Oh, I had to switch off my phone because I guarantee you the conversation just now probably cost me about $70, but that's fine. So I'm now just using my computer through Gmail, so I have my keyboard right near me, so occasionally you might hear that.
So we misinterpreted. We answered you like it was a free conference call, but it wasn't in your case.
No.
You should get Vonage, Bipple.
I don't think they offer that. Or I could. I knew what I was getting into.
$45 a month.
I'll have to look into that. Yeah,
well, I charge more, so you're getting a good Bob deal here.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, sorry. Bob's going to start charging for readings now. I'm actually the first proponent for it because I think I owe him a little bit of money for overage on sessions. So,
yes.
Bob's going to set up a PayPal account. Carolyn's going to set up a PayPal account.
Okay, here's what McLuhan, in the middle of the civil rights battles in the mid-60s, McLuhan says, the South, in the South, which is not industrial, the white man considers the black man a competitor for the same agrarian environment. He actually had a non-emotional response. He talked technically about what the North calls racism in big cities is not the same in the South. It's a totally different thing. The white man's a threat to the black, and the black man's a threat in a very primitive, not an environment where there are cops and police cars and the normal urban setup. And so it was shocking to see someone discuss racism without seeming to take sides. Do you know what I mean? And if that kind of affected you, instinctively knew. You knew that the culture was way more complicated than what TV was telling the English people about Rhodesia.
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I have multiple stories that would illustrate that point.
Yeah. And that's what McLuhan was saying, that the different technological environments make people different. You can even say different human nature. And that's all. That's a simple way of what he was talking about. Now, the complex part of Marshall is that he saw the digital world and the complex world we're in now. He needed finning his way to describe what was coming. But his basic tool, which was look at the technologies in your culture and see how they shape you, that's a simple point to get, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I wanted to get back to, did Biffle get his question answered there about the about acoustic space?
Okay, well, I was there the whole time, so you mentioned something about your great-grandfather reading you a story, and that's what I kind of remember as the beginning answer to that question.
No, he would tell us stories. He wouldn't read anything.
He'd tell you a story.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty unique... Sasha, do kids today have anything like someone telling them stories
in their
modern family?
No.
You don't know of any.
Well,
no,
I know
not,
that.
Not that I know of. Not without a book, anyway.
Right. It might have a book. Read the book. But that's a pretty interesting situation, having a guy just pour out stuff all the time. Well, like, where would he get all these stories from?
His experiences.
Oh, he'd just tell you his life story.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty neat. What do you think of that?
Oh, I mean, it was fascinating. I mean, he lived on a farm out in the middle of the bush and, you know, been there for, God, years and years and years. And, you know, so, yeah, there's hyenas and jackals outside the gates and, you know, all kinds of, you know, it's literally the middle of Africa.
Wow. And so, snakes around?
Oh, yeah, all kinds, all of it, all in the above. But that was just normal. Yeah, I mean that is pretty special to have, like you just said, to have.
Now, look, here's an example I'm thinking of. Sasha. If you took one of those tough 14-year-old girls in London or guys and stuck them in your place, they'd be scared shitless of all the animals and that. And then talk about the song you like, "New Animals Waving Goodbye" on Bosnian Ecology. You're used to the animals in the African context. And then there was a new kind of animal in the urban scape for you, the way the people were.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. Because the first thing that the people, the transported Londoners into Sasha's environment, the first thing that would be terrifying for them would be the silence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the sky as well. The sky is vast. And, you know, I mean, you know from Winnipeg, Biffle, that... You know, how amazing when you go out into the middle of Manitoba. I lived in Manitoba, so I know how deep the sky is and how, you know, this is what, you know, how Bob brought this up earlier. You know, when I was walking around with my daughter in the park, and she said to me, I feel so slow. You know, every time I come to this place, I feel so, like,
too slow.
Yeah,
where?
Feeling slow. So.
This is in Victoria, British Columbia.
Yeah, there's a park that I go to in Victoria, which is a bit of a, I call it a parallel park because it's quite an anomaly. From a geographical kind of perspective, it doesn't look, none of the plants look like Victoria or the West Coast, or anything. It's quite odd. But I walk there every morning, and I take her there, and she's like, oh, Mom, I don't know why I feel so slow. And I said to her the other day, it's because you everything's slowed down, and this is all that is.
You're in the slow chemical body.
You're in your chemical body. You don't have your phone. You don't have your Facebook. You don't have your, you know, the Twitter is the new thing as well now.
Right. It's like, maybe what's the exact word? It's slow. What she means is you've got less information to process. And processing any little information data is a span of time, a bite of time. She didn't have many bites of time happening.
Well, yeah, it's completely, she's overwhelmed by the simultaneousness of the invisible.
No, she's overwhelmed by the poverty of stimulation.
Yes, yeah.
Well, okay, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
The poverty of stimulation could also be, you know, there's nothing there, so theoretically it's invisible, right?
Right. Okay. So the stimulation is invisible. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I'm relating this back to McLuhan, because he would say that he got a sense of the all at once-ness based on the prairie and how you could sort of see forever again. You know, like there was no interruption, you're full field. And didn't he call the environments, you know, like the visual space was like connecting a line, and the electric is an entire field. So,
yeah, a sphere.
A sphere. And I think she's just, her daughter is just, has no nothing to empathize with. There's no anthropomorphication happening.
No, there's no sphere or no, it's linear what she's experiencing, and that's really tiny. That's a very limited experience from her perspective. And, so that's an example of what we start off as, the unconscious. She became aware of her unconscious, and that unconscious is all the stimulation in the home of all the four bodies. So when she lost that, she said, this is weird. What she really meant is that she was really becoming aware of her unconscious, which was the technical multiple environment she was in.
That she came from.
And it's like the filter for her kind of got timed out. Like, let's say like a website as a template, the website has to load up the components. But sometimes if you have, if the connection drops out, then the browser times out, so to speak, trying to load the components. So I think maybe she tried to find some type of something relational based on her experience to that point, but there was nothing. And so like it just kind of like it became, you know, the unconscious, the invisible, you know, becoming sort of aware of something that has never been articulated, you know, in you know, in any way, shape or form previously.
Yeah, the your use of the term invisible could be acceptable, but what she's used to is invisible. She becomes aware, it becomes visible when she goes to the park. In the sense, visible means she starts to notice, I'm missing something.
Yeah, she gives it, the park becomes the symbol or the figure.
Yep. And the slow movement of her body, of the chemical body.
Yeah, because there's nothing to react to. You know, you see an animal, you're going to react. You see another person, you're going to react. In this sense, it's so overwhelmingly static on the surface that it's almost like you can't even see or sense your own reaction.
Yeah, now this is what I notice and ponder about in Maui. These tourists come. They spend a week, and I've heard them say, overheard them, that they cry when they leave such beauty. But they can't stay. Actually, they require the stimulation they think they get in the cities. And so it's an illusion that that they're coming to a better place. They're coming to a diminished place. In reality, they can't stay here.
I was actually going to ask you this, Bob. I was talking to my friend Heather about this the other day because we were laughing about what you call enforced relaxation or forced relaxation as vacation.
Yeah, forced idleness.
Forced idleness. What would you define as retiring?
Retiring is planned obsolescence. That everybody prepares for. Yeah. You know what? It's interesting. It's planned. Like when you work, you have your weekend. That's enforced idleness. Now you imagine when you retire, you're going to have a lot of freedom to do things. So you know you're going to be obsolete, and it's actually going to flip into ultimate hypermobility.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the people can't do that because they're probably projecting, okay, my chemical body, when I'm free, I'll travel around the world. And they don't notice that actually they travel every day when they're watching stuff on TV. And they probably get bored pretty quickly because they're mistaking freedom of the chemical body as some kind of better level, but actually it's a diminishing. Because when you go to work, you can work on computers and you engage with several environments. You're on the phone. That's a electric body situation. So you see, it's a big joke on humans. They really walk through it backwards through the rearview mirror. They think they're going to an enhanced, upwardly mobile situation, and actually the closer they get to planned obsolescence, they're going to be limited because they're just going to be able to do chemical body mobility.
I love it.
Well, it's like, they can contrast the small amount of forced relaxation of the weekend because they know deep down they are always pining for their job because it gives them something to do that doesn't require them to have to contemplate.
Now, yeah, I as I walk around and, you know, enjoy the beauty of Maui, we came here a few times over the last 40 years. But I know that I didn't want to be here. I wasn't into having vacations. And I walk along, and everybody's just sitting there, roasting in the sun, and reading their Kindle book, and really aimless. And they all look like it all looks unhappy to me. You know what I mean? They're glad they can go home. But see, I'm walking through. I go to the beach and enjoy the chemical body pleasures. But it's only a small part of me, and I come back and I can engage with the non-physical, I engage with the computer. I would not want to, and I never want to go sit on a beach. You know, what's the point? But these people are either so exhausted, they just sit around and flop and then go to the local restaurants. It looks so limited, their great vacation.
Because that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, enforced idleness.
I find that too. I mean, you know, I'm one of the worst people to go to the beach with. I get bored of sitting about 10
right.
minutes. I'm like, okay, let's, you know, I've done the sea, I've done the lying here, I'm really hot. Okay, let's go and let's do something.
right. Let's just do some other body stuff or other levels of another environment. Get in a car and go to another environment. I remember in 71, I was driving around L.A., with Dave Worster, and many times we'd go there and we'd be slumming with Dave Worster and driving through some part of L.A., maybe with great music on the car radio, and Dylan's song came on. It was about 1971. He had not made his comeback, but he was sort of making records, and he was living in the village in New York City. And the song was, one of the lyrics was, it struck out, because we were going to the California beaches every day. He said, I was sick of lying here on this bag of sand. It was like a complaint about being on vacation and glad to get back to the city. So I remember sort of being shocked at that. Well, this guy's complaining about the beach. He's knocking what I like to do. And I thought it was great, but I don't know if it was enforced idleness. Well, see, here's the point. When we went someplace, like California, we'd hang out with Jerry Fiocchi or Dave Worster where there was like revolution going on. We always engaged ideas, and that's really what was going on. The beach was just a benefit. But if you just went someplace...
The background, it was the scenery.
Great scenery, but we were still involved with whatever we were talking about. Maybe talking about Cosmic Awareness, McLuhan, this or that, Zappa, go up and see Zappa. And so when I see people on buses, like when I went to London, they're running around on the buses doing the tour. It's so fucking stupid. It really, talk about little men. You go fucking into the tourist world, there's little man. There's a hopeless sad sack of quiet desperation trying to spend his time by himself or his wife looking at stupid historical artifacts. And I'd have more fun at Jerry's place. We'd go down on the Venice Beach where they had a Hyde Park, and we'd get on there and rant away at the people. This would be Dr. Dean's vacation. Go down and hang out with the semi-homeless. It's like Pam Wall. She likes hanging out with the homeless on Venice Beach. It's sort of a bit like that. Mm-hmm. And that, but at the same time, we were connected with interesting things. That Jerry worked for Zappa. So it was always, like I say, I've never been off duty. I'm always on duty, always engaged in sort of hyper-communication all the time.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what you're talking about that about. I'm thinking about retirement as well. And there's a really great British show called One Foot in the Grave. Have you ever seen it?
No, I don't know it, but I can.
Oh, you have to watch it, Bob. One Foot in the Grave. It is hilarious. It's a show essentially around
the grievances of retirement.
The grievances of retirement from the perspective of a couple.
Yeah.
And the husband is driving his wife absolutely bonkers.
Right, right.
He's spent the past, 45 years or whatever in her home doing her thing and having her routine, and all of a sudden, shock horror, her husband is home.
And she's got to, she's got to service him and deal with this interruption.
So funny.
Yeah, but it's sad. The I had a point there. Joan Dark, Joan of Arc, Joan Dark of Paranoia magazine. She says when we first get over here, so you and Carolyn are retiring? And actually, it was once Ian showed up. She says, you and Carolyn are retiring? Like, you fake? You're like, what are you doing retiring? I said, we're not retiring. We're more busy than we ever were out here. But it's in the chip body we're busy, organizing sessions, doing this, all this with Ion. Now I think if I didn't have Ion, I don't know what I'd be doing after a few years here. I'd be just doing shit like this and McLuhan Seminar.
Well, it's all serendipitous, right? I mean, trying to get back to a couple of things we were talking about. I mean, didn't McLuhan say obsolescence is really not what people think it is? Obsolescence means when
there's more of it. Obsolescence means more of it. That's what the meaning was.
Yeah, it's completely accepted into the fabric of society that it's not even noticed anymore.
No, here's the way he would describe it. In the era of printed books, 100 years, there was more handwriting in the 19th century than there was in the 12th century, when handwriting was the main, most advanced technology. You made manuscripts with handwriting. And handwriting was the new technology. It gets obsolesced by the printed book, but then everybody starts writing letters. There's postal services. So there's more handwriting in the post-handwriting situation.
Exactly. So I'm saying, the obsolescence in that it's so accepted. Now, I mean, it's not accepted on, a level oh, yes, I accept it. It's just kind of it's so accepted that people are affected.
Right. No, that it's a cliche environment that everybody accepts. A lot of the radical stuff or conspiracy stuff or whatever that have come up in the internet age, most people didn't question the Federal Reserve. Money was public property from the 30s till the 80s, and people engaged with money, and it's what they call reality. You got to deal with money. It's a given environment. It's actually, you don't have to deal with it. It's given, but you got to have a position in relation to it. That's a cliche environment, and it's a given, and and it's obsolete.
Right. And so when people are, working and they're always obsessing about the weekend and obsessing about retiring, it's almost like when you do retire, that is your ultimate acceptance of work. Because now that little stupid fantasy that people that aren't qualified to speak when they say things like, oh, I wish I was the boss. Well, guess what? Now you have your wish. You're the boss. But guess what? You don't know what to do because you've always been told what to do.
You've
now
been retired. Your whole 30 years of employment was actual retirement because you had a convenient job to go do. And as long as you did it and it was still there, your routine was given.
It's like you already were retired. Now you're
just now you got to work.
Exactly. So it's like this one night stand fantasy of endless leisure.
Yeah.
You got to raise that kid now, bitch.
Right, because a job is leisurely. You go to any job, people, they know how to do a little bit of work and look like something's getting done, but they talk to their friends, you know, at the water cooler, whatever. Now, this is all different now, right? This is the old image of the when there was a civilization. But the you can see the ease of work. It's easy.
Well, yeah, you can see the ease of work in the same way that the mainframe got replaced by the PC. You know what I mean? Like, there's always a technological innovation that surrounds the previous infrastructure.
No, no. Well, when the PC came in, it wrecked a lot of people. I talked to this woman who was a welfare bureaucrat for many years, you know, graduate of Winnipeg in social work, gets a job in the Toronto social welfare system, and says when they got the PCs around 95, it made everything ridiculous. They would spend 2 days of data processing before they could visit someone, whereas before in the 80s when they didn't have the computers, they could visit five people a day on welfare and deal with it, but the computers created extra job, and everybody started to get sick because either cathode ray thing or other factors, a carpal, whatever it is, elbow and all that. It was a disaster. What?
Carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah. Carpal elbow.
Carpal elbow.
Of course, I've never had it, so that's good that I don't know anything about it. But the point is that she described it. It was for her, computers were an invasion by terrorists that fucked everybody up, and they have never got over it.
It was an innovation that they weren't prepared to deal with. They didn't want to have anything complicated.
It made their desk job even more desk jobish, you know?
Well, they didn't want to deal with the
environment,
bugs.
The new work environment is the virtual environment, and that's the environment that I work in, which is, you know, I'm discarded from my office completely. I'm not even there.
Right. So what are the disservices and services of the situation?
The disservices are that I'm not able to have the water cooler conversations.
Right, you're by yourself too much.
Right. I'm speaking from the perspective of the company and my job and
right.
what, you know,
right.
I have to do. So I don't have the privilege of having those kinds of conversations. I just sort of have email or project management software related tasks laid out, and I have...
You actually have more work kind of things.
Right, but also at the same time, I don't have a boss kind of thing.
Yeah, you
don't
have a boss.
Anyone.
That's an interesting ratio. Because what I mean by work is when you're in an office, you have a rhythm. You can work for 15 minutes, then go over and talk to somebody. You know what I mean? And that's a five-minute break. It's leisurely. Then you go back to your job. It's without that, you're constantly on the treadmill of doing a task. But you also can jump around and watch YouTubes.
Okay,
well, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you know, what the water cooler, that's, what do you call that? That's phatic communion.
Yeah, phatic right? communication. Yeah.
So I mean, like now, with the technological innovation absorbing the previous, let's say, the previous technological innovation, the mainframe to the PC or the physical office cubicle, now with the virtual home,
yeah,
where Sasha's doing her work from wherever she happens to be, the phatic communication happens through serendipitous this is where like the distraction.
She makes is phatic. Making ads, as McLuhan said, are not supposed to be noticed. She's creating phatic environments.
Right. Well, I mean, like that's particular case. But I just mean like the water cooler interaction that's not there because of the virtual environment that Sasha's working in. I think that the email, that's why emoticons, which are really anthropomorphizations, the smiley
yeah.
face, all these things are taking on additional sort of like acoustic characteristics, and which is why I guess the mobile or the smartphone, where you'll have people in the same room on a committee at the same table, literally next to each other, texting each other.
You mean in the – yeah, right. I'm thinking that that's why now I know, Sasha, why you spend so much time on the phone. You actually, Ion has given you a phone, a phatic phone community, but even it's not even phatic. It's like it seems like it's a very serious topic. It's given you people to talk to.
Oh,
well,
yeah,
it's the equivalent. It's the equivalent of the Victoria Park. It's slowed down the hey, how are you? Fine, how are you? It's slowed that down into the electrical microscopic where each pixel of the word is analyzed and given. It's given a waveform, and the waveform might have a mountain range shape in it. You know,
actually,
you know,
it's given magnetism, polarity, and frequency. Those are the three factors.
So. You know,
it absolutely has, Bob.
Yeah.
You know, and as these environments change, you have Second Life, and like, you know, we see things still in a 2D sort of like, you know, 2D environment on the web.
That's if you accept that, though. Right?
What do you mean?
What I find interesting is that I'm able to extract myself from that environment and be able to look at it. But I wonder what it is like for other people.
Well, your British show, The Retirement, they aren't doing computers, I assume.
I beg your pardon?
That retirement couple show you were talking about. They have no chip body going on in there.
Well, no, they wouldn't. They wouldn't because, you know, this is probably, 15-20 years old, that show.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, so it's because a lot of people, I met a lot of older people told me in the late 90s, they liked computers. It gave them something to do in their retirement.
Well, once they got over the fear of...
Right, typing, and they then found out how easy it was. They actually spent a lot of time on computers, but... So you're seeing a caveman situation, like ancient history with this couple, Shell. It's before they got a digital body.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but I mean that they weren't used to anything else. So that's what's interesting about, you know, observing that whole scenario. Absolutely.
So what, you know what I just realized? You know, I created the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs in 1992. I'm realizing that we were coming into a society, the digital, everybody in 95 starting to get into the computers, where there was no more phatic communion. I was celebrating the past environment, phatic communion. There's now archetypal intensity. Let's remember when we had time to be phatic. It's a new meaning for my book.
It's a lot more of an informal phatic now. Like, rather than directing a question, the tone of each other's voice and the timing of the conversation, can we not talk all over each other? That's the acknowledgement of dimensions in a way.
Yeah, a lot of people are on forums. They're typing, listening, reading stuff between appointed tasks. You know, and maybe not today. Now it's Facebook, right? Everybody, which I don't.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I have a fantastic gauge in my daughters, and Alex, being my eldest, fascinates me because she does not do email, and Carolyn actually mentioned this on Cashflow the week before last. She said, you know, yeah, the young kids, they don't do email. Alex does not check her email. I could send her an email or send her, you know, an interesting link or something. She's constantly on the computer, but she does not communicate by email. It's Facebook or text message.
Now, that would be Web 2.0. So email is Web 1.0, right?
Yeah.
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 Web 2.0.
Yeah.
So they have a whole different computer world than the images we have.
Yeah. They don't even communicate. Yeah, they don't. She doesn't even. And she doesn't even use her telephone to call her friends. She doesn't talk on the phone. They don't talk to one another.
It's visual.
Yeah, they don't, unless it's Facebook or text message. They
hear. They use their ears. They listen to YouTubes and links that has music and sound.
Yeah, but they won't talk to one another. Like I've said to her before, you know, we've been out in like downtown and. Yeah, it's like, hey, our mama is going to meet my friend, and no problem. Oh, she's going to meet us here at 2. Oh, she's not here. Well, you know, she's like, I'll text her. Wait 15 minutes. She's still not here. I was like, call her. She actually looked at me at one point. She was like, Mom, we don't talk to each other.
Right, that's amazing.
Yeah, she said that, which is amazing.
Take this with Ion. Ion says speech is the only reality. It's the most important everything. It's the only thing. And I think I've hinted that people typing, it's Madame Blavatsky back in the 1880s. I think she died around 1890-91. She wrote a big book, can't remember the title now, but she predicted, Garrett Dean used to tell me this, she predicted in 100 years it would be, the kids would be a subhuman race. In Ionic terms, they are subhuman. They're not using their main organ, speech.
No, they don't. They don't. They don't talk. They don't talk. When I was her age, I'd spend hours on the phone with my friends.
Yeah.
My parents would be like, get off the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but they don't actually talk to one another.
So what... So they look, they hear, they look, listens rather passive, but they're active typists. They type,
yeah.
type their messages, which is tactile, I guess, the fingers. And so they would never listen. See, this part, she would not listen. No, would they listen to a speech in person? If you address them in person in speech, they're not going to be able to stay with it very long, right?
They don't. They have a very, very, very limited time frame.
Right, attention span. That's the real attention span factor. It's it's not attention. They're not used to that medium of speech. Why passively listen to someone?
And I actually realized this because, you know, like, you know, of my previously stated background and need for manners and, you know, all this kind of thing. And
you are you typing while you talk?
That's me.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe mute.
My,
what are you doing? Who are you typing to?
Oh no, I'm trying to remember things to bring them up.
Oh, okay. You're making notes yourself. All right, that's acceptable.
You have the context.
Yeah, you can't type unless you're working, and working means participating and responding to this.
But Sasha, before you go on there for a second, you did say that story about your daughter once before, right?
Probably.
Yeah, I think so.
Bob and I have an ongoing theme. She's a barometer of.
Yeah, we use her. She's our canary in the mine. We're wondering if she's going to make it to 20 years old.
Well, okay, I'll be 10 seconds and then go on. I was picking up someone, and so I texted them, and they didn't respond back. And then so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to leave. And so I had to tell my mom, you know, I can't pick her up. And so she's like, why don't you knock on her fucking door? I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. And she was there.
Yeah.
So it's just like it's the kids are just, I think they love the convenience of the myth of the separation that they naturally.
Now that might be too many words. No, look, like I criticize people. You said they love the convenience of the myth of the separation. Now why put the word myth in? Why maybe separation?
Well, the myth of the young person wanting their private world, separating their identity from the adult world, you know, like how grade fivers and grade sixers and grade seveners, you know, they're all like distinct societies, and they try to like hang on to this little window of exclusivity for as long as possible. So for them, using their phones to text and only text and talking may as well be opera to them. And it's just kind of like... they take hello, how are you, and they over-research it, where all their communication is basically like, you know, hi, I'm in the third dimension. Yes, so am I. But they could be saying like, so-and-so bought a new T-shirt at Forever 21. Justin Bieber is cute. Selena Gomez is cute. You know, like all the conversation is still the same stuff that if you were to switch it to mine and Sasha's generation, she might be talking about Duran Duran or something. And, you know, like it's the same idea, like, you know, band
it's
music.
The same sharing of space, but it's a sharing of space. That sharingness of space is the big issue now, what I call ESP, the nostalgia for connecting. Where Sasha wasn't trying to connect when she was young. She had people all available to talk. They, today, aren't sure if they can connect to anybody.
Well, this
so they're
is how
hyper.
They do it.
Yeah, they're just staying connected.
Right, so they're producing volumes and volumes of text messages, but it's basically like trying to read Finnegan's Wake from beginning to end. They don't really, it doesn't make any linear sense. So,
right.
You know, like the conversations that they're having are kind of like, you know, 2 p.m.
It's the form. It's ESP.
Yeah, exactly.
The content is very minor. It's the tactile. They're actually living in an invisible resonating space, and they are atoms bumping up against each other, and they just want to make sure there's someone they can bump up against.
Like,
yeah,
what a drag it is getting
great.
Old. You know that Rolling Stones song where Mick Jagger says, what a drag it is getting old. For them, the generation now of kids, it's like, what a drag it's going to have to talk.
Yeah.
I like the idea of the what Bob just said about the atoms bumping up against one another, making sure that they're there. That's exactly what happens. I mean, you know, I actually physically watch them, and they get on Facebook, and then both of my kids, and they're like, oh, who's there? Oh, Tina's there. Oh, Ashley's there. Oh, hi, Ashley. How's it going? It totally is. And it's like, the noise of the Facebook chat thing
right.
in the background is just like...
And now you can go back, Sasha, and say, in a slower era, when you grew up, you were beginning, because the connecting thing is always threatened by the discarnate electric environment. You guys spent hours on the phone. That's an earlier, slower form of worrying about connecting, but not so obvious.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and the dialing, right. For my mother's era, it would be the rotary phone. And for mine and Sasha's era, it would be the touch-tone phone. And
right.
this technological, you can gauge things like by the technological limitation. Like they would have rap music that was recorded in 1999, but they would include the sound of vinyl crackle from a record at the beginning of the songs because they'd try and invoke a whole era. And now, like, if I go like this...
Now, when's that? That description applies to your generation or what, now?
Was the generation...
No, it was an either-or. Don't say, it was either-or. Give me the time you're referring to, but the beginning.
Let's say 1995 to 1999.
Oh, okay.
You know, the full commodification of hip-hop. And so for it to feel genuine again, they had to insert sounds of records... from like the 70s, they wanted to get the vinyl crackle to make a record from the 90s resonate with the idea of when it was real back in the 70s. And, you know, like I just take that and look at like, you know, all these technological obsolete things gain a new insight into the present, post-relevance. And my tapping on my keyboard, well, first of all, Sasha's kids are going to think I'm old just because I'm not using a phone.
Right. Now, let me say this. That's the definition of holopathic. The kids using vinyl records, sounds of vinyl records from the 70s in their 1998 record, they're evoking a technological simulation of the world of records, which was an earlier form of virtual reality, just like movies was an earlier form before that. The virtual reality of the last 15 years is always in the invisible. It's homeopathic. You can't see it. It's an environment like a hologram. And so when you refer back to a nebulous aura of records from the 70s, that's physical. You know what I mean? Yet it's just, it was virtual back then.
Well, it's like one of those French philosophers probably paraphrasing McLuhan, but I think one of them was called Lacan. Had a concept of the stain, like a stain on your shirt. And it's like the stain is like a symbol of the unconscious. If you think about the situations leading up to the creation of the stain, I mean, clearly you're not trying to. And it's like the crackle of the records is a product of their environment. And it's just like, whether you want to call it autism or not, but compartmentalizing that, extracting it and reinserting it in an environment where it doesn't exist anymore in order to invoke it when it did exist is like Finnegan's Wake, where the media are the characters.
And that's exactly what my charts meant. I take the phrases cliche and archetype, and they were called holopathic cliche probes. So the last 30 years has been taking previous virtual environments that have gotten even more invisible, and they were virtual, then they become physical or archetypal. But it's always within the non-memory world of homeopathy, the non-substance world. So that's exactly why my chart was a series of holopathic cliche probes. I'm just saying what you're saying is giving me words to tell you what the chart meant, which I didn't have these words or conversation to tell you a year ago.
Yeah.
I'm always waiting to find a way to explain what I couldn't tell you 6 months ago.
It's funny, you know, that Australian broadcast of McLuhan in 77, you know, I hadn't watched it, the full thing, up until recently, a couple days ago. And when I made that clip on August 22nd, I called it, I called it McLuhan video, but the actual technical term of what I made in the video, the title, was reversing the rear view mirror, misunderstanding media, McLuhan at 100. And in that Australian interview, he said, I used to think that when you looked in the rearview mirror, you saw the past, but I realized that I was wrong. And when you look in the rearview mirror at things, you're oftentimes confronted with the future.
Right. Because the rearview mirror is another term for the archetype. The archetype is agreed, shared patterns that the group, tribal, or whatever now sees. Like, what would be an archetype? Wayne Gretzky is an archetype.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then he says, the retrieval of archetypes, because you need more and more content for all the media, so they retrieve everything. Think of Mad Men, the TV show about Madison Avenue, or any of the shows, the retrievals. You're taking old archetypes and making them new, making them appear new, and that's called a cliche probe.
Exactly. It's exactly what we were talking about just now with the hip-hop record and the CD.
So McLuhan was saying, it's interesting, but he kind of has to plot along with the dumb people that are interviewing him. But he laid it out real sophisticated in his book, From Cliché to Archetype. But he can't really go into that in a 5-minute interview. But he's saying the rearview mirror becomes new resource for showing the future or creating the future.
Well, yeah, and you're resonating with, let's say, you know, now all of a sudden you can take your smartphone and record your record player if you find one, get that sound, put it into something new, and it's like you can really zero in on aspects and reinsert them, which then gives them, you know, the pun of a different meaning. And you went over this really well with I don't know if his name's Scott, not Scott Taylor, but when you
Scott Norris, when we did Fatty Communion.
Well, when you talked about aesthetic of rock.
Right. Oh, that was with Scott. That's Scott Woods in Toronto.
Scott Woods. Yeah, like that's when you really, because Meltzer's going through all the different cliches and.
Yeah.
You know, like.
No, I really, that was great what I did there in terms of the McLuhan cliche archetype. His great writing allowed me to say better patterns.
Well, yeah, you know, and it lets us look at things in a new way. Mad Men coming on makes you appreciate the tailoring of the clothes, the reaction that you feel seeing cigarette smoking. Look at this Herman Cain ad. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but people are freaking out because it shows a man having a cigarette, and it was filmed in 2011, and he's talking about a current issue. It is a real actor playing themselves that look like a lot of other people, but, you know, like
McLuhan's definition of charisma,
right? Which is like, it's like the, it's not even like, it's
no,
like,
no, he's looking like a lot of people 20 years ago when they smoked.
Yeah. But it's, but he's speaking about something today. So it's like, it kind of causes a wrinkle in logic. Cause it's like, this isn't.
No, wrinkle in logic. That's what I wanted to tell you about. If you get a glimpse of this cliched archetype process, Sasha, which is a whole book in McLuhan, and he said it was the nature of consciousness, you see how Ion completes that. When he talks about the now, past, past, becoming the now, then, he's talking about layers of cliché archetype retrieval and probing. He actually has the perfect language and completes McLuhan.
Mhm. Yes, I totally see that. Absolutely.
Yeah, substitute cliche and archetype, or rearview mirror and archetype, for every time he gets past, present, future, put these McLuhan words in there. That's what he's doing, because he's trying to explain. See, the original point is what Ion's saying. If we were just cavemen, what he says about the now, past, present, that's true on the deepest level. But we now have the Android meme simulating that crazy chaos butterfly. So there's two layers of past, present, future, past blue perfect mixed up kind of stuff. There's two layers, and Ion is like slight talking through it.
Yeah, Ion is the force of the vortex.
yeah. What is that? That's he's the butter knife, you know, through the butter, the hot knife that goes through the butter or something. Some kind of slicing through. He slices and dices.
Or it's like, well, but, you know, it's one form inside the butter, and it's another form entering and leaving the butter.
Yes, yeah, all actions at the same time.
Well, you know, that's the great thing about that descent into the maelstrom thing of McLuhan, and like Ion, you know, kind of represents the maelstrom as, you know, a conscious maelstrom. And yep. Let's face it, the maelstrom, you know, people say, oh, it's an act of nature. Okay, fine. You want to switch the word nature with whatever else word you want to switch. I mean, it's conscious on some level as a human being. If I'm in a boat and all of a sudden there's a vortex, I'm not going to be thinking about, well, geez, who scheduled this? This is very inconvenient. No, I'm going to be like, okay, I'm human. The least I can do is see what's floating, if in fact I want to live.
Yeah, and noticing that everything gets sucked down, but some of the things pop back up. So you grab onto something that you know will suck you down on the bottom, but it's made of a certain weight that'll pop back up. And so he survived, whereas his brothers tied himself to the linear perspective or the solid point of view, tied himself to the mast, and he had no flexibility going in and out of the vanishing point, so he went down. That's the story of, if you don't know it, Sasha, the Edgar Allan Poe, you know, 100, 200 years ago almost, story of the patterns of retrieval and probing right there in this story of the descent into the maelstrom of the fisherman.
Like in 59, I think, McLuhan wrote that article or essay, Speed of Cultural Change, and he talks about how Edgar Allan Poe kind of created the first, not his terms, but he's saying, like, by making a detective novel, he's inviting the reader to engage with the material and engage.
Yeah, participation. You help make the storyline.
Sasha, back me up here, but engagement has got to be the most used buzzword for any type of internet advertising. That's definitely one of those ones that keeps popping up out of the vortex. Is like, you got to engage these people. These people need to be engaged.
That is by far the entire.
It's called the lingua franca, the common terminology, lingua franca.
Yep, engagement, call to action, CTA. We even have an abbreviation for it.
Awesome. No, I mean, like, I'll, you know, like everybody else, you know, like I'm working on, you know, we're all doing stuff in our spare time, but it's my opinion that if you got people an interface that worked where they could start connecting pretty much anything in any YouTube video on their own, like kind of like proactive micro employees of companies they haven't even applied to work at, that's what's going to happen for all, you know, if you want to break it down into some type of like tangible figure at 8.5 years a day.
Okay. You know what I say to that, Bipple?
What?
That you got to take that notion and fit Ion into it. Is offering the solution in all these different levels of communication.
Hey, you guys, speaking of offering different levels, I'm going to have to go. I've got to deliver my children to their archaic educational institutions in the morning. So.
Okay, well, it was great. I'm glad we brought you in. It was really good. And I think we'll end anyways ourselves because we usually don't go too past two and a half hours. So, no, it's a good point.
Yeah,
I think we ended up with saying that what he just said about YouTube and connecting, I is trying to get you to realize how much you are connected in many ways, how you're disconnected in the interplay, and is offering new kinds of technologies for that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
awesome. Totally great.
totally.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot, Sasha. You'll be a big
guys. Have a good night,
Sasha. You'll be a big star in Doofs when the teen is and all that find out Sasha was a guest of honor for a mum.
Oh, aren't I privileged?
That's right. So find out. Let's figure out if it's totally LinkedIn. This is my email anomaly, the longest running anomaly, or is there a non-physical chip body aspect to it? You know, I'm interested in what it is.
Well, you know somebody, a thing that would be able to give you the answer to that question, Bob.
Well, I did that. I've already talked to Ian, and he pumped his case that it was him. But this other point.
Well,
that,
I mean, it was pretty interesting. I mean, like, you know, like I said, I did kind of go, my programming brain went and I was like, okay, well, maybe it's copying this code, but then I was like, I don't know, it's too late for me to.
Okay, we'll work on it next couple of days. It's our homework.
No, but the underlying question mark for me probably would be the fact that the system clock. was the same, but the time left in the show,
the segment,
the system clock was, yeah, the segment was staying the same, but the time of the report,
right,
current, which is very bizarre. Oh, and not only the time of the report, but also everyone else's inquakes. So the time at the top was the same, and then everyone's inquakes is like, you know, regular Pacific time.
Yeah.
I thought there was, you know, at one point I was like, okay, no, that kind of makes sense. I can see how that would happen. But then when I scrolled down, I started seeing that everyone's inquick messages were in current time.
Oh, they were? Do you mean that they changed?
Yes. Yes,
oh, I did. Oh.
Yeah.
You mean they would they have different dates? No, just the time, not the dates. Just the time. You're saying they're changing too.
The time that they put the message in
is changing also.
Yes.
Wow, I didn't get that. I didn't notice that.
And
I'm not sure if that doesn't make sense. Sounds like it doesn't make sense, but I have to bounce off other people to think to find it. Like you
that
think
that
does,
that's pretty. I mean, like I said, I don't know what you've done, what you've copied and pasted, or what's been going on there, but that's quite interesting.
Yeah, okay, good.
It shouldn't be changing time, no.
And I find it interesting that some minds will say, no, you just got the code. They will not allow the question of, well, maybe it isn't just the code. You know what I mean? They'll block. Others will accept bring in the mystery landscape as a factor. But, you know, there are people
who... I would have to say that I'd have to bring in the mystery landscape on that one because that's...
That's good.
If all of that code is accurate, then your clock on your session time or your radio time or when you're going to break should be zero.
Right. Okay.
Or plus or something weird.
So we began with this, you know, many hours, 2.5 hours ago, and we ended with this story. Very good. Thanks a lot, Sasha.
Very good. Thanks, Bipple. Have a great night.
You too.
Okay, Bipple, I guess that's it. Bye. Is that it, Bipple?
Yeah, you know, that was great. You know, it was nice to talk to you both and Andrew. And
yeah.
I think we came to a lot of good things that haven't been said, at least not very many times.
Right. No, you're right.
And, you know, like it's always great to be a part of something that's trying to be filling the void rather than just enlarging it.
Right, and the thing is that it was a little more relaxing because you didn't have to compete with other callers. You were able to relax and say your bit, so it wasn't so panicky.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's it. We'll stop the tape and we'll talk to you next time the situation arises.
All right. Well, have a good rest of whatever part of the day it is for you.
Yeah, it's about 11 o'clock at night for me.
Okay, it's about 4 in the morning for me, so I'm going to do what I do, have something to eat, watch some bad television, and fall asleep.
Okay, thanks a lot, Pitbull. Talk to you later.
All right, take it easy.
Bye.